Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 69 of Dominaria's Judgment, a constructed magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax, and also this week, Bobby Fortinelli, who will be joining us for our main segment here for a deep dive on perhaps the best deck in Pioneer. I guess the jury is still out on that one in Mono Green Devotion. So excited for that, and then we will be bookending that, as always, with a pretty extensive batch of modern results from the past 2 weeks, because we took a break last week, but we have more than enough to catch up on here.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't argue Mono Green is the best deck, you have to be arguing for Rakdos. And does anyone really want to do that? Like, is anyone out here besides Misplaced Ginger putting themselves out in public and saying, yes, Rakdos is the best deck in Modern?
You could make some contrarian case for something else, I suppose, if that's how you'd like to have your fun. But yeah, regardless of what your actual stance on that question is, I think everyone agrees Mono Green is one of the best decks, and you should expect to play against it, and should perhaps expect to play it as well, depending on your overall views and your preferences there. So I think that segment will be very useful for a lot of people, and having finished recording this, to give a behind-the-curtain peek here, I think I can confidently say that your Bobby is worth listening to on that, and also on most other things. One of the smarter minds on Magic who I'm always keen to hear from.
Yeah, we've tested together for a number of events. I think the one that most notably comes to mind was a Grand Prix back in Ixalan Standard, which involved us playing the 6-mana Ajani and Carnage Tyrant and just beating up on Scarab Gods with that, which was pretty awesome. So, yeah, always has really good insights, always very good at kind of cutting through and saying, oh, these are the things that we need to formally make decisions on in certain formats, and, like, always there with the giant binder of sideboard notes for literally every situation.
Yeah, the literal physical binder, which should strike fear into the hearts of opponents across the table. So a great segment there, but let's get into the many, many results that we have to sink our teeth into. And we'll start things off. We won't bury the lead. We had the Modern Showcase and also Pioneer Showcase, in fact, last weekend on Magic Online. So one of the more high-stakes events on that platform. And this is, in some ways, a reassertion of some points we made in the past, where it feels like regular four-color, which I guess at this point the Traverse list is fairly stock, has dropped off the map in the challenges, but you would expect in a more competitive, more focused tournament for that to be more well-represented. And sure enough, we have a Mental Misstep, Stefan Schutz, continuing a truly absurd run through this layer of Magic Online results. I think this is the fourth out of seven possible showcase / qualifier top eight. So really making a run back to the Mox leaderboard there. And then also another copy in the hands of One Big Pin _, who I don't recognize their name from these or other results, but good to see that doubled down upon there.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing that is kind of notable is basically, a little bit above these is that we still see four-color creativity putting up basically the same results as normal four-color these days, winning the event in the hands of Uriel, a name that has floated around Magic Online, and I do not have any idea of how to pronounce, and then also another copy in the top four in the hands of Bruno Caleb. Both the pretty traditional Ren and Six based list, none of the super heavy persist stuff, though we might touch on a little bit of that in a second.
Yeah, creativity, actually the single most represented deck in this top 32, and then also in the 7-2 or better results that run through 21st. So you can make a case, honestly, for creativity being the best deck / deck to be by whatever metrics you like to use at this point. And certainly something which I don't know if it's fully made the jump to paper. Anecdotally, at the face-to-face open in Toronto this past weekend, there was shockingly little creativity compared to what you would expect and compared to how much has been showing up on Magic Online. But certainly on that platform, this is perhaps the deck to beat at this stage.
Yeah, and I mean, the other argument, four color has been one of the decks to consider in that slot. And the other one is it? And there's no is it in this top eight. There is a Grixis Shadow, which is a deck that has actually popped back up again because of Leyline Binding. So if you are leaning heavily on Murktide Regent and your whole thing was that your opponent is only going to have so many ways to kill it, well, if they have Leyline Binding, that's kind of not true. But Leyline Binding is not much different than any other removal spell against Grixis, and it can just kind of take care of it along the way.
Yeah, you have both more threats in total and more cheap threats at one mana. So yeah, if they feel the need to Leyline Binding your Ragavan, then your Dragon's Rage Channeler and your Death Shadow can team up to get the job done, and you have a little more staying power going along. You also can potentially line up Thoughtseize against Binding in a spot where maybe they don't have the ability to get the full discount yet. It's not costing one mana at this stage, and so there is a window to take that removal spell if that is the hole in their hand that it can't compete with otherwise. And worth noting that the copy of Shadow in the top 8 is in the hands of double underscore BMJ, aka Ben Jones, who has been playing Shadow religiously and producing content on the deck for years at this stage. So someone who will be looking for any excuse to go for another run with Shadow, and has succeeded with the deck even in hostile formats for it. So that by itself is not a conclusive sign of anything. But there is another copy in the top 16 here by GN42, and Canister also moved back to Shadow for this event but did not have as much success.
Yeah. Rest of the top 8 is a couple big mana decks here. We have a mono green Tron in 5th place. It looks like I may have been wrong about the inclusion of Inscribed Tablet in these decks, but otherwise... Oh, sorry, Eldrazi Tron. I'm sorry. Wrong Tron deck these days. This deck is Eldrazi Tron. There are 3 Mana Reshapers. There is an attempt to make progress there. Moving on to the next deck.
Three Chalice of the Void, which I guess maybe the argument is you do actually want the immediate access to that via Khan in the matchups where, like, if you're against specifically a Cascade deck or something, I could see the math working out such that having the additional access via Khan is more important than just the increased odds of drawing a Naturally. But either way, it's just a weird number to try and line up on the deck list. But this is one of the mysterious things about Modern, where it feels like in the regular challenges, you have to look far and wide to see Eldrazi Tron putting up results or having any success. But whenever we get to one of these big tournaments, these like qualifiers or the showcase challenges or whatever, it seems like there is just an obligatory copy of Eldrazi Tron that just runs the tables in the Swiss and then finishes in the top 8. And I'm not quite sure where that discontinuity comes from.
Listen, I will not try to rationalize the existence of Eldrazi Tron at any point in time past about 2018. So we're about half a decade almost beyond the point where I'm willing to talk about it, and moving swiftly onward to Hogpog.
Yeah, so this is Aya Karamchandani on Amulet featuring Scapeshift. So this is an innovation that she has been pushing and touting a lot recently, which, having watched her run through the tournament in the VOD, I don't think the card Scapeshift was actually cast a single time during this tournament, so would not be too much into its placement here. I think it's more a case of just someone who knows Amulet well putting up a good result with it. But the Scapeshift twist is a pretty interesting way to take the deck, because this has been the issue with Amulet for some time, is there are a few different ways we can build it, and we've seen innovations on that front recently with stuff like the Secure Tribe Elder and Hydroid Crisis stuff that's running around. But there is an issue of what is your next best threat after Primeval Titan. So you can lean harder on Cultivated Colossus, you can try moving back to stuff like Khan the Great Creator, but none of those options really appeal that much. And the allure of Scapeshift is that it is this like mana generation engine that can be quite explosive, which then in turn leads you to be also being a threat in the form of one card, if you have the right setup. And that's the issue here. So if you have a Dryad, then you can attempt to emulate the Dryad plus Scapeshift accelerated Valakut kills from various other decks that we've become quite familiar with. And then if you have the card Amulet of Vigor, this was something that people were doing in the very first big bottom tournament in Pro Tour Philly, you know, many years ago at this point, with Cloud Post and setting up like Ayavugin through the breach lines with that. This is a little more tame in that sense, but if you have this starting base of resources, then the card can really let you pop off. So you can do things like you have an Amulet, you make your third land drop, you cast Scapeshift. Those 3 lands turn into 3 bounce lands or some combination of Crumbling Vestige, Castle Gandrick, stuff like that. That gets you to 6 for Titan. So it can be this seething song of sorts in that sense. And then if you have even more lands to work with, then it can also become this additional threat. So let's say you have five lands or you have four lands with some mana floating, you scale shift into a Talaria West and several bounce lands. You can then pick up the T West and some of the other lands, transmute the T West for a Summoner's Pact. That pact gets you Titan or crucially Cultivated Colossus. And one of the interesting angles about scape shift in this deck is I think Colossus kind of sucks for the most part, and I would love to fill that void by just playing more Colossuses, but it's tough to talk yourself into doing it when the average output of that card is pretty unimpressive. But in conjunction with scape shift, it's phenomenal, because if you're picking up four or five lands en route to transmuting for your pack that finds your Colossus, well, now that Colossus is popping off, it's generating more mana than you spend to cast it, and guaranteeing that you find four or five spells on the back end there. So that is almost a guaranteed victory in spots where, even if you know there's several face-up copies of Solitude or what have you, like, you can very easily overpower that. So that is the allure. The problem is that if you don't have a Dryad that survives or an Amulet, then Scape Shift looks pretty underwhelming. And so in one sense, it's making your good draws even better. But the issue has never been doing impressive stuff when you have Amulet. Like, that is kind of the baked-in assumption. You want to optimize your decks for the games where you don't have that. And this is why, like, I tried Scape Shift when Dryad first came out, but that was my finding, is, you know, I need to pair it with one of these other cards, can't do that consistently enough. Now, the new wrinkle is you have Urza Saga. So Saga can find Amulet to make those lines more consistent, but if it's doing that, then it's doing that on the way out and lowering your total land count in the process, and so the scape shift that it's trying to enable is going to be weaker. So there's a lot of weird variables that you have to fudge there. I don't think this is going to become like a widespread change. I haven't actually seen anyone else picking this idea up, but nice to see it on the docket at least.
Yeah, I want to shout out that you can also just like fire off escape shift and find two Urza Sagas and just make a billion constructs against someone when they're like, I'm thinking like in, I don't want to say the Rakdos scam matchup, but things adjacent to that where they are shredding your cards but aren't necessarily Blood Moon. It's just like, oh, I'm going to cast Scape Shift and do some stuff and you have to deal with it. Same thing with like Scape Shift as a gateway to Cavern of Souls. Like you mentioned, the Cultivator Colossus line, but there has been a decent amount more Azorius control these days, and that is like a pretty threatening card for them to have to play against.
It's tricky because in order to set up your mana base to actually cast the card Scape Shift, Cavern of Souls doesn't really let you do that because it can only mana fix four creatures, essentially, and getting to double green, even in your mono green ramp deck, is actually surprisingly difficult sometimes. And so you kind of have to shave a copy or two of Cavern of Souls here and there to get Scape Shift into the deck, but then once you do, it provides another means of access to Cavern of Souls, even if you have to jump through a few hoops first.
Yeah, skimming down these results, we see a lot of fairly familiar decks. I do want to highlight that if you control F and search for Kasali Ambusher, it does in fact show up as a 2-of. So,
Yeah,
Surprise Cat flashing around still. Anything else you want to highlight from the rest of this top 32, or should we skim down to some of these challenges?
We have Lucas Giggs on Calibrated Blast, a deck that they are becoming somewhat known for at this point at 7-2. And then also Killer SUV, part of this kind of Glimpse of Tomorrow cabal that consistently is putting up results with that deck, and yet another finish in the top 16 of this tournament, or just outside the top 16, but still at 7-2. So looking good there. And then I guess the story of the past few weeks has been the Rakdos Scam deck, or Black Red Grief, as I think Goldfish has it labeled. No headline results for that deck in this challenge, but we do see, you know, a copy in 20th, and then Soulstrong, a friend of the show, just in 22nd there with it as well. So it's still showing up, but not having quite a good weekend as it has had in the past.
Yeah, it has fallen away a little bit recently. And I will, as we, you know, jump to the challenge that was also won by Creativity, I do want to highlight Turn the Earth as a like fairly problematic card in that matchup out of the sideboard. Like, there is a very specific window for Leyline of the Void to come into play for the Creativity decks, but Turn the Earth kind of, like, a lot of the things that it brings into play in terms of, like, shutting off the Feign Death lines and, like, buffering your life total, like, it's just a much more effective card against them than something like Leyline. Even if you're already, like, you know, the Creativity deck does have to accept some amount of, like, beating Blood Moon, but when you have, like, Turn the Earth and Veil of Summer to cover everything else, and the game becomes just how do you maneuver through a Blood Moon, it's a little easier.
It's also a nice hedge against like Living End, which is a matchup where you really do need the help, and then against Burn or something, it's technically a source of life gain as well. So it just kind of covers a few different bases, even if it's not a card that you would turn to, I think, if you had access to just the generic or like Relics or Unlicensed Hearses or whatever that is the go-to graveyard hate these days.
Yeah. So jumping into this challenge, you know, Creativity in first, Izzet does show up again in second place. And we're pretty consistently seeing Dragon's Rage Channeler supplanting Ledger Shredder. This list actually doesn't even play any Shredders and has moved to Subtlety, which is fairly interesting to me. That has been a card that, when I've played as it, has felt fairly specific in its applications. But if you are skewing to try to beat like 4-color and the rest of your Izzet deck presumably beats a lot of the rest of the metagame, Subtlety does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's if you think that a lot of the traditional 4-color share is going towards stuff like Creativity, then that's a shift that really does not favor Subtlety, I think. It's good against stuff like Yawgmoth, which we're going to see become the big story of the past 2 weeks as we get through the rest of these results, but it is a much more polarized card, I think, than a lot of the other stuff that might traditionally go in those slots. But maybe the actual comparison is Subtlety versus some of the additional interaction, if that's how we want to think about it. So this list does also have two spell pierces and a spell snare in the main deck, and you could read Subtlety as being just part of that bundle where I take a little bit from here, a little bit from there, and get this like weird spread of interaction that's kind of hard to play around consistently.
That's a fair assessment of the card, is kind of like backing that weird spread up. I would have to play more with main deck Subtlety and see. But it does seem important if you are going to be playing against Amulet Titan, another copy, no Scapeshift showing up in fourth place here. This is just the 8 million Hydroid Crises across the 75 list that has become the other weird default for the deck. And then Dredge in top four, a deck that really hasn't been seen in a long time. This is the same Dredge deck that you kind of always see with a bunch of reunions and thrilling discoveries.
I mean, it's weird to say at a time where the flavor of the month is a deck that has just 3 to 4 main deck Delphi Voidwalker in it, but it feels like there's not as much like really hard graveyard hate going around as there has been in the past, and the go-to is stuff like Unlicensed Hearse, which can be annoying, but you can also power through that with a good draw a lot of the time. And I know Sodek tweeted something to that effect earlier, so I still think things need to line up very specifically in order for Dredge to be a good call. But when it is, it's like, oh yeah, it's kind of a genius move, which is going to give you great odds in the tournament if you pick the right moment.
Yeah, I would lump this in with the other decks that are improved by the lack of Force Negations right now in the format. Just like Living End and the other Cascade decks being on the decline, because a lot of this deck is about, you are basically mulliganing your opening hand until you have one of these specific enablers, which often means that you have a pretty weak hand to your like thrilling discovery just getting hit by Force Negation. Even with Reunion, like you don't really get that far off of just discard 2 cards and slow Dredge.
Mm-hmm. What else from this Sunday challenge from last week do you think is worth touching on?
Well, you do see the precursors of this week's results with Demonic Tutors in top 8 with a Yawgmoth deck.
I don't know if that's a precursor of anything or if it's just a... That's what you expect from a weekly modern challenge, is Demonic Tutors top 8ing at least one of them.
That's fair. I do want to highlight the Nishoba Brawler Territorial Kavu Domain Zoo deck in 10th place. This deck had popped up a little bit. I don't have a great opinion of it right now, but this has kind of been my struggle. Like, a lot of the decks recently that have popped up, I've been running into them when I'm playing like the known good deck that is going to be a huge issue for them. So like, I don't know, I'm playing Azorius Control, and I have Dress Down and Supreme Verdict in my deck, and the Zoo deck has no chance. Or, like, I'll play against Merfolk when I'm playing Rakdos Scam, and my deck is just triggering Fury every turn of the game. So I don't have the biggest read on how good this deck is, but it has shown up a couple times in interesting spots, so it may be worth another quick look.
Still in the early stages of development, and there's a lot of stuff you can do with it, just being a 5-color deck and so on, but I think the core is quite promising. So this is a good leyline binding deck, just as a way to deal with basically anything and also remove whatever could be a troublesome blocker for your just big dumb idiots. And you have even more big dumb idiots now with Nishoba Brawler. So this is the one in a green X3 trample from DMU, where it, the power is equal to your domain count, effectively. And so once you have Brawler and Carvu and Cyano Draco, you now become a deck that can support Summon Denial, which it's not clear on any given weekend if Denial is a good card, but when it's good, it is a very strong reason to play whatever deck can support it. So this was true back in the days of like classic Grixis Death Shadow, right? Where if Summon Denial was good for that weekend, then Grixis Shadow was probably a good deck. And here, we've been mentioning how your creativity is perhaps a deck to beat at this point, or you see a lot of these like random combo decks, cascade decks, calibrated blasts, and so on. I want to be stumbling Denial those people back into the Stone Age, and this is a great shell to let you do that.
Yeah, there's, I guess the other thing going down in these results is there's a weird amount of mill floating around the lower tables, but that could just be, okay, you know, tiebreaker variants of the week. You ready to jump into this week, which has a very different flavor?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so both challenges are won by Yawgmoth. Two different players. Obviously, one of them is Demonic Tutors. The other is Control 4 Days. Lists are relatively stock. I mean, the Yawgmoth list doesn't have the most flex to it. It's a lot of the same cards. You know, here's a Prosperous Innkeeper here. You know, here's a Thoughtseize in the main deck over here. Someone has a Crime Punishment. That kind of stuff. But overall, the deck winning a lot, which is surprising to me because it implies some things about the format are rapidly changing, because this came up in the Discord. You know, if you want to join that, take a look at our podcast Twitter account, and it will be linked there. But the discussion in the Discord was that a lot of the decks that have become popular over the last month or so are really, really bad matchups for Yawgmoth. Like, well, Rhinos is having a resurgence because of Leyline Binding and the four color list. Bad matchup. Creativity, not a great matchup. It's just like a combo deck that interacts with you, and then Archon is a disaster. And then Rakdos Scam is just a giant fiasco of like, how do I beat Recursive Furies and then also Dothy Voidwalker that I can't kill because they just cast Feigned Death on it when I Minus Grist?
And sometimes you get punked up by Blood Moon. There are a lot of ways that matchup can really go wrong for you.
Yeah, I think that sort of signals a break in that, at least for this 1 week, and we'll see if it persists or not. The second place in both of these challenges might be almost as interesting as the first place. So in one challenge, we have Merfolk, another deck which I said, you know, the Rakdos Scam matchup for this deck is a nightmare. It's yet another deck that cannot defeat a Fury basically ever. But here it is, winning against things that aren't Fury. Well, Daleen Hexcatcher is... it's been about what I expect it to be, which is it doesn't fix the big problems with the deck, but it has improved the deck overall more than I expected. So I think Merfolk is a fine choice for when you don't expect the deck's bad matchups, as opposed to like maybe being a little closer to the margins than when it previously didn't have Hexcatcher. But definitely an improvement, but not an improvement that fixes the problems. And then we have Bob 49 in second place at the other challenge with, a new Bob 49 just dropped.
He has entered his Amulet Titan era, and we love that for him. I still think I'm going to make fun of the Merfolk community because they just make it so easy, but not going to make as much fun of Merfolk as a deck, which I think, with the help of Hexcatcher and a few other changes, is a legitimate choice if that's your speed. I think I was also puzzled by York having such a good week at a time where it felt like most of the developments in the past few weeks have been negative for it as a deck. But I think the way to synthesize that is that Yorg is the combo deck which improves the most in sideboarding against other combo decks. So game one, typically, against some of these cascade decks or creativity, amulet, what have you, can be pretty bad for Yorg. It's just not fast and also not disruptive. But then when you get to board in, the perfect bullet to Eldritch Evolution or Call of Calling for, right? Like if you expect a lot of Amulet Titan, then one Magus of the Moon in your sideboard, just adding that and having 7 to 8 virtual copies of it can really flip that matchup by itself. On top of that, you have Thoughtseize, just a nice catch-all across the board. Necromentia, which you can cast as early as turn 2. And then if your opponent is weak to Force of Vigor, you're a very good Force of Vigor deck. And you can really customize your sideboard accordingly there. And so I think that, I could see game one being pretty tough for Yorg against creativity. I think I like your odds in post-Cyborg games, though, once you get access to the Thoughtseizes and Necromancers and so on. And I think that kind of applies across the board, where if you can gain enough equity in sideboarding, you're going to be good in a lot of these matchups. And I think there are matchups more broadly, stuff like your Grinding Breach having a pretty good few weeks online as well as offline, where those are just good matchups across the board. So I think that, and if also you have Merfolk, you have Goblins, you have like Hammer has been having a pretty good few weeks. A lot of the decks, just like small creature combo decks that Yawgmoth is meant to beat up on, still does a pretty good job of that too.
That's totally fair. Let's see, the other interesting developments of this top eight, there is a top eight that has multiple copies of Valky God of Lies, one showing up as a tutor target for Elidamari's Call in a pretty traditional four color list. It's just the addition of a black land for Leyline Binding has meant that you just have access to black mana for Valky, and notably Tybalt on the other side is just kind of this like split alternate high end to Emrakul. But then the other one, longtime Bring to Light enthusiast Melton has shown up in yet another top eight with what looks to be a very new and unique take on Bring to Light Scapeshift.
Yeah, so this is leaning even harder into the kind of fair mid-range deck angle where we have four Omnath and four Soul of Windgrace in the main deck. So I've seen Spike messing around with like a 4.5 color Delirium deck with like one Omnath and one Soul to traverse for and something. We're not minimizing that aspect here. We are leaning as hard into that angle as possible. And with that in conjunction with Leyline Binding and also these dual toolboxes of Bring to Light and Wish, we are now at the point where we kind of have to become a Yorion deck, which is maybe what we wanted to be doing anyway. And so there is a lot of stuff going on here and a lot of access to all of those different things.
Yeah, Soul of Windgrace, notably easy to miss that it puts a land from any graveyard onto the battlefield under your control. Oh, so
I had
you
missed
don't
that,
even
in fact.
Need.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so it is a very weird card. This is the Jund Legend from Dominaria United, one and, one of each Jund color for a 5/4. It reanimates a land from any graveyard when it ETBs. And then it's got a bunch of activated abilities to gain life, draw a card, or give itself indestructible by discarding lands and paying mana. Just like another Omnath-style big threat with a little bit of value baked in. But yeah, just, there is a traditional Scapeshift list in the other top eight. Just a lot of this sort of combo mid-range floating around between those, Creativity, and Is It Breach in a top eight as well, which maybe another reason why the Voldalion Hexcatchers are really good right now, just against these decks that aren't necessarily like Fury based, that card is going to be a problem.
Yeah, worth noting with Soul of Windgrace is on top of all of the other things that it promises you it can do, it is just like a thing that ramps you when it comes into play, and so or attacks even as well. So you could imagine games where you go, turn two Growth Spiral, turn three Soul of Windgrace, and then by after you attack on turn four, like you have six lands in play, and you're very close to a lethal Scapeshift or just a Bring to Light for whatever already at that stage. We do have the one Time Orb here to Bring to Light for as well to kind of keep that chain going. And I'd mentioned in the past when I was playing four color Bring to Light for a bit, had tried switching out Bring to Light for Wish to kind of get around to Fairy and lower the curve a bit. But you can also just do it all, right? Once you become a Yorion deck and you have Bring to Light and Wish, where, for example, that Scapeshift endgame, which is so good at going over the top of basically anything, well, now you have the one Scapeshift in the main deck, of course, and for Bring to Light, you can also Wish for Scapeshift once you get to that stage. And so that's something which you have very consistent access to, but you only need, the one plus one copies to have access to that, and that kind of applies across the board. So there's Supreme Verdict in the main deck for your Bring to Light, and we have like a Fury in the sideboard for your Wish, which you pay for three mana, you get access to the Fury, cast that for free. That's a line which, if you need to break the emergency class early, you can do that. And so I like how this is optimizing for flexibility and consistency at the same time within that constraint of any card, which is pretty tough to do.
Yeah, that is, it's very impressive. It's, the kind of thing that's been happening to these combo control mid-range decks where, like, you are fitting in a lot of fundamentally good cards so that even if your combo elements are disruptive, you're a good deck. And if your good elements, like your fair elements, are disrupted, you just kind of cast Escape Shift and you have the escape button. So yeah, it's that deck is interesting, and it's on my long list of new decks to try out that have really popped up over the last few weeks. Anything else to say about these results skimming down the rest of the top 32 here?
I guess just a final thought on that Bring to Light deck is that Leyline Binding can fill a similar role that it does in these bigger Cascade decks now, where that line of spend one mana, get Teferi out of the way, and clear the way for Bring to Light, that is much easier than having to, you know, pay three mana for a prismatic ending to kill the Teferi and then follow up with your big payoff on the same turn. Like, once your once step A of that process just costs one, it's a lot easier to kind of get past that edge. So I like that angle as well. Going down to 11th place, we see Twiddlestorm, a deck which has about as polarized a matchup spread as you can hope to have in the format, but when it's good, it looks close to unbeatable. This is a pretty interesting twist on the deck where we have, I think this might be the first deck list I've ever seen with two copies of Amulet of Vigor in it, just in general, where usually you're either building your entire deck and game plan around that card, or it's something you would have less than zero interest in. Here it's just, sometimes it's a weird, like, ritual of sorts for your Lotus Field, and other times it just doesn't really do anything.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Twiddle that sort of stacks. It's very bizarre in the stack.
Well, this version, we've seen a lot of Twiddle Storm lists where you have this arcane splice package based around Psychic Puppetry. So that's the 2 and a blue, tap or untap target permanent, but it has splice onto arcane for just a blue. So if you can fill your deck with Reach Through Mist and Peer Through Depths and Ideas Unbound, then you can graft a Twiddle effect onto all of those spells to have them either become mana neutral with Lotus Field or generate mana in the process. Once you free yourself from that constraint, like, Reach Through Mist is not a card you want in your modern deck otherwise, you get to play stuff like Consider, and you can build your deck the way that you might want to play it, and so you can kind of cast your gaze across the format at large, and this, once you have four Twiddle, four Dreamscript, you kind of run out of Twiddles at that point, and this is the next best way of doing that.
Yeah, this feels a lot like the equivalent to how the Lotus Field decks in Pioneer leveled up from, like, their original Hydra Crisis forms to Underworld Breach, I believe.
Yeah, and I know Brian Cook, you know, combo master and enthusiast in every format, has been really going deep in the tank on building different Lotus Field combo decks. So I think his most recent list was, it has one Lotus Field in the deck, and the idea being that the rest of your mana base is DFC, so you can Abundant Harvest to guarantee that you find the Lotus Field, but crucially, you can also Recross the Paths, which is easy to forget in Belcher, where you have no lands, but Recross does put a land into play if it finds one, so you can Recross for the Lotus Field to find it, and then if you've already found the Lotus Field, well, now Recross is doing the same like quantum doomsday shit that it does in regular Belcher too.
Oh gosh, this is gonna be a that deck's gonna be a lot, isn't it?
It is quite something, yeah. Okay. So should we? I guess wait. This is. I'm losing track of time. This is already this week, correct?
Yes, this is already this week, which means it is time to talk about Pioneer and Mono Green, which is, I guess there technically is a Lotus Field deck in Pioneer, but the Mono Green deck feels like it is sort of supplanting that in that format as just, like, the big threatening combo deck of choice.
Yeah, it's tough to know with your Lotus Field deck what you're hoping to prey on at this point. I guess the answer is if Rakdos Midranger is the deck to beat, and also they don't feel the need to respect you by sideboarding Alpine Moons or Damping Spheres that have no other applications elsewhere, well, yeah, you can feast on those. But I don't really like your odds against, you know, the Mono Green decks or the aggregate decks that are hoping to beat up on the Mono Green decks, or God forbid, Spirits or what have you. Like, I think there's a lot of accidental hostility to the deck in the format, even leaving aside the fact that, as we mentioned, that deck is kind of capped on how fast it can be. It's become more consistent with the most recent set release, thanks to Impulse and also Inscribe Tablet, but when speed is a limiting factor, there's not much you can do about it, and I think that is the point that we're at now.
Yeah, but Mono Green certainly has a little bit less of that cap, a little more density, and we can talk a bit about how that deck has found its way to the top of Pioneer.
Yeah, so we're going to get into this a lot with Bobby. I've never understood why the results with Mono Green are so wildly divergent week to week, where there are some weeks where it just completely dominates the opposition and reminds people why it's widely regarded as the best deck in the format, versus other weeks where you have to cast your gaze down the top 32 to find a copy of Monogreen, if that, and it's like, wait, this is a deck that people are saying is busted and defining the format and something needs to be banned from? Like, really?
Yeah, I mean, some of that may be the same kind of swings we see in Modern with 4-color, because, you know, Pioneer did win the showcase event. Monogreen did win the Pioneer showcase event, but at the same time, it's like, not if it's not showing up elsewhere, then where's the 4-color and all these other challenges? Well, maybe just the good players aren't playing it in that event.
We do have a new addition to the mix from this event, which is Indomitable Creativity, which made some waves in paper. I know at the team open in Baltimore a few weeks ago, like, this was one of the breakout decks there. And I think that player, Benton Madsen, taking their talents to Magic Online, finishing here and putting up some good results as well. And so this is trying to creativity into Xenoghost, God of Rebels, and Worldspine Worm. So the Worm is an 11 mana 15/15 with trample. When it dies, it shuffles itself back in, crucially, so you can discard it to Fable if you draw it, and it just goes right back into the deck. And when it dies, you make 3/5/5 Worm tokens. So even if the opponent has one of the limited number of ways to kill it on the combo turn, unless that thing bounces it or exiles it, you're going to get a formidable game-winning board presence out of it as well, which also means that, you know, sometimes against a deck like Black Red, you can just creativity into a Worldspine Worm. Like, this is, you know, my article last week was actually on the various ways you can build the deck. One of them is to just play two Worldspine Worms instead, which means that you can creativity for one instead of two, which is much, much easier to do, and still generate this incredible bargain for four mana that is nigh on impossible to kill. So lots of choices you can make in deck building, but there is this like gigantic structural flaw in the blue-white matchup. And blue-white is a deck that gets remarkably little press for how consistently well it does in every large Pioneer tournament, but no surprise then that the story of this event is creativity exos the Swiss, makes it to the finals, where it gets beat up by blue-white control, which no one pays attention to because the story that people are focusing on is, oh, look at all of these mono green decks that are top 18 as well.
Yeah, I mean, Azorius Control, it's easy to dismiss that deck in the context of Pioneer because I guess a lot of Pioneer decks fall under this trap, but like, it's got a lot of the Graveyard Trespasser problem going on where it's like, oh, we got all these absorbs, and it's like, yeah, that's just a 3-mana answer in a non-rotating format. We can do better than this, right? And the answer might just be no, I'm going to cast for well, everything's going to go away, I have perfect control over the game, and like, do I really need better than this if the Supreme Verdicts in my deck are good enough?
Speaking of the Graveyard Trespasser problem, or maybe lack thereof now, I think one of the narratives which has scared people off Blue-White is, well, Rakdos Midrange was kind of a close or tough matchup before, and now that they have Liliana, like, that's a card which is really difficult to overcome. That being said, it feels like the blue-white players are just winning anyway, despite that, and not caring too much about that card. So I don't know if that is just a trade-off that they're making, and it's dragging their win rate down a bit, but it's still high enough across the board to be winning most of these tournaments, or if actually Liliana is being overhyped as a threat in that context, and, you know, blue-white has the tools to fight through it, which I can kind of see, actually, because, you know, cards like the Wandering Emperor just line up pretty well against Liliana in some of those low resource games. You know, if you suck a Teferi or something already and you're protecting it, then Liliana by that stage of the game is not doing much for you. So if what's happening is people are trading in Trespasser, which I think was actually one of the better threats in the deck against Blue White before, for Liliana, maybe it's not a wash exactly, but it's not as much of an upgrade as it might need to be.
Yeah, and also if you look at a lot of these Azorius lists, they are really heavy on ways to defeat a Liliana. So, like, traditionally the issue has been, like, okay, they're going to play Liliana on turn 3, and I have to have one of my very specific ways to answer it. I'm just pulling up a list from the challenge this week, and they have Censor, Dovin's Veto, and Make Disappear for when they're on the draw, and then also all those absorbs that I sort of made fun of on the play. There's just a lot of ways to make sure your opponent doesn't resolve a 3-mana sorcery. This list actually even has Loxodon Smiter on the sideboard,
oh, hell
which
yeah.
Might be going a little far.
I know that Nassif had Orvar the Allform at one point, the thing that when they make you discard a card, you can instead like make a copy of something. But that one, you can at least cast for 4 mana sometimes, like if it really comes down to that. But I love the moxie of just... Did they even have a Sparrow's Headquarters or something?
dubious. Okay. It does not appear that they are going to be casting this card off of their lands.
Yeah, I love that there are like three different cards that enable that subgame versus Liliana, and you can really try to show up and punish those people if you want to. But I think that is, more seriously, like an actual relevant point, which is Liliana plus Fable means that Dovin's Veto is a more consistently good card against Rakdos in the way that perhaps it wasn't before, where it was effectively only Fable, or it was stopping a Thoughtseize from taking one of your more relevant pieces of interaction, but it wasn't doing that much for you. Whereas now, I think you're pretty happy to have Veto in your deck and draw it in that matchup.
Yep, that all checks out to me. It is interesting how these like small changes across the format shift all that. Make Disappear is also like another card that's really interesting because Quench has been legal for so long. And it just happens that sometimes your like 1/1 Shark Typhoon token can turn your Quench into better Quench, and that's good enough.
I remember the days where, you know, we had to play Revolutionary Rebuff and be happy about it, but it feels like we have firmly emerged from that desert now.
Oh gosh, don't remind me. I don't want to even look at my deck list from that Grand Prix and think about it.
Well, I will not force you to relive that trauma. We can move swiftly on to what, I suppose. It feels like we have kind of speed ran through most of the relevant tournaments here.
Yeah, we can move right on to our main segment, where we're talking to Bobby about his expertise with Mono Green, his involvement with evolving the deck over the last few months, and kind of the metagame breakdown and shakedown of where the deck, and I guess technically it's sideboard, but really it's wish targets, all sort of fall in Pioneer these days.
All right, so for our main segment today, we are joined for our Mono Green deep dive by, I would say, one of the pioneers of the deck, and certainly one of the current biggest authorities on it that I would want to listen to here, Bobby Fortinelli. And I think Bobby is someone who, if you're dialed into competitive Magic, you probably do pay attention to what he's saying and what he's playing, but maybe doesn't have the largest public profile. So, Bobby, thank you for joining us, and give us a brief introduction to yourself in whatever level of detail you think is important.
Sure. So my name is Bobby Fortinelli. I've been playing Magic for about 12 years. I play decks that are off the beaten path a bit, sort of similar to the kind of decks you might see from like Julian Henry or Canister. I found that I mirror their deck choices a lot. I used to travel to a lot of Grand Prix pretty frequently back in the day, between 2016 and 2020. The decks I enjoy the most tend to be kind of off the wall. This is like Kiki Pod, Malira Pod, Death Shadow Zoo, KCI, Amulet Bloom. I'm known for Amulet Bloom back when it had the Summer Bloom. I won a 1,000-person SCG tournament in early 2016, and it got banned. The Summer Bloom got banned the week or two after that. So I like my way around a ramp combo deck, and so this is quite in my wheelhouse. This deck, actually, this mono green deck, this is the first time I have played a significant amount of Magic just for fun. The last time that happened was when Summer Bloom was legal, and this deck is fun in a way that's not just me like preparing for a major tournament, but like, you know, playing for fun. So I really like this deck.
Yeah, that was what first clued me into to get you on my radar, was that open win with Summer Bloom as like the capstone finish for the deck before it deservedly got axed the next week. And since then, as you mentioned, there seemed to be this pattern where this, I don't know if it was an explicit brain trust or just this kind of informal coincidence, but players like you, Canister, Lysurg, and a few others you could bunch in there too, seem to gravitate successively towards these decks, which were maybe not on the radar yet, or they were known quantities, but people didn't know quite how good they were. And it seems like some of you would do the work to refine those, and then those would have their breakout finish, and you had already been in on the ground floor there. So, you know, the Shadow Zoo deck, KCI, Lantern, I think, is a great example too. And does it seem like this mono green deck really falls explicitly within that lineage?
I would say so, yeah. It's pretty good. I mean, like any deck, it has strengths and weaknesses. It's not perfect. I'm not saying that it has no bad matchups. But it has a lot of really strong things going for it. And whenever a combo deck has a sort of strong fail case of you could just make a bunch of power and beat your opponent to death, that's a good place for a combo deck to be, is to be able to win even when your like ability to straight up combo fails.
I think one issue that I had at first, and that a lot of players who are coming back to Pioneer now that it is more part of the competitive scene are having, is that when Pioneer was first created as a format, Mono Green Devotion was this big litmus test, one of the defining decks, at a point where it had a lot of these more broken tools, stuff like Once Upon a Time, Leyline of Abundance, and so on. And the deck back then looked very different from how it does now. And the deck kind of, after those bans, dropped off the radar entirely, would pop up here and there. And it's only been in the past, I would say, 6 months or so, post the expressive iteration and Renota ban, that the deck has really cemented itself as one of the top contenders in the format. And I think I had a lot of trouble at first kind of updating my heuristics, because I had this image in my head of this like turbo Nissa Who Shakes the World deck with a lot of these like very specific lines from the early days of Pioneer. And this current iteration is reminiscent of that to some degree, but it feels very different in a lot of ways as well.
Interesting. That's a nice history lesson. See, I had no priors about this deck or Pioneer as a format. I had never played it before June of this year, when someone was talking about the mono green deck and how busted it was. And I was like, this sounds really good. Let me try it. Like, there was a SCG team tournament that I topped for right before the pandemic started in Phillies in early 2020. And so I had like looked over to my left, because I was in the standard seat, and I saw the Pioneer seat, and I saw there was some stuff happening, but I didn't know anything about it. And team tournaments kind of just stay in your lane. So I had no priors about this deck. And so I've heard a little bit about the iterations that came before it, but that I didn't have to go through any loops to update my priors. I just like saw the deck as it was, and it seemed like it fit really well into the format as it existed at that moment.
And so when you were getting that introduction to it yourself, what were the things that either stood out to you at first that you then later had to update upon, or weaknesses in those initial iterations that you felt you were able to make substantial improvements on?
Well, in terms of things that took me a bit to learn, I mean, the combo lines are a pretty significant stumbling block, because when you're playing a deck like this, there's two sorts of skills you need to get good at. The first one is understanding when you hit the requirements, being able to do your combo and executing successfully, and then there's the setup for that point, so understanding like how to navigate the game in a way such that you enable yourself to do the comboing. And so you kind of have to learn how to do the combo part first, to learn how to set yourself up to put yourself in a situation where you can combo, or make it your opponent has to like answer your ability to do the combo. So combo lines took a while, and then I guess just learning, you know, the patterns of the deck, like how Wolf Willow Haven on turn two into like Kiora plus Old Growth Troll is a pretty good turn three, sort of basic stuff like that, and learning how to reason about activating Nykthos. I think about it as like it sort of taps for Devotion minus two when you're doing like turns where you activate Nykthos multiple times. But there's a lot of sort of things going on with the deck. There's a lot of moving pieces. But once you get good at the deck, I think that you actually have very few decisions. Your turns are basically all entirely scripted pretty much the entire match. And so once you sort of learn how to, the sort of contours of the deck, you don't have decision points in the same way you would with, say, the Rakdos deck, or almost any other deck in the format. I think you actually, once you learn the deck, you have almost no decision points like at all.
Yeah, this is one thing that I think it does share with the various instantiations of Amulet Bloom across the years, which is that people would kind of fixate on these very flashy combo lines and some of the more obscure things a deck is capable of doing, like what's the fastest possible kill and stuff like that, while kind of overlooking some of the basic mathematics of the deck, which you kind of need to internalize in order to play the deck confidently. And then also, in some ways, the math is tough to figure out from first principles on the fly, which is why it's worth memorizing as much of that decision tree as you can, so that you only have to solve for some smaller part of that. But also, and I guess if you're playing online, right, if you're on Modo versus paper, this is one big difference where you can just have this extensive document or spreadsheet open there to cross-reference in real time in a way that you can't in paper. And I know that there have been a lot of reports from the trenches, from RCQs and so on, of mono green players who seem like they should have the game sewn up, and then they make some, you know, silly algebra error and leave the opponent some theoretical out to win, which, if they do manage to realize that, becomes this great story you can tell afterwards. But it feels like when people are picking up some of these decks for the first time, it's easy to kind of get focused on things that either don't matter as much, or which are actually pretty easy to get past, and, you know, they're kind of not focusing on what really is important there.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing that certainly can happen. I guess you mentioned, so I have pre-computed a lot of, like, sort of the various combo and mana requirements. This is, like, as an exercise to learn them for myself. I don't actually reference them all when I'm playing online. Like, once you know the devotion requirements and mana requirements, which I can get into a bit later, you just sort of, like, add up, like, two or three numbers, and the answer is like I can combo or I can't, and then you just sort of execute. But it is pretty common for people in paper, if they sort of haven't learned how to do this, to mess up. I mean, one deck that this isn't as intricate as I used to play a deck in Legacy called DDFT. This is Doomsday Fetchland Tendrils. This one, my spreadsheet had 500 or 600 lines of various Doomsday piles. This was back before like you had cards like Thassa's Oracle to make it easy mode. It was really intense, these like Doomsday Fetchland Tendrils deck. And that deck, I think, also had some similar aspect to it that this deck has, where because it was like so hard to do the combo, or for some definition of hard, it sort of had this sort of mythical status that it was like a deck that humans like didn't really play, but if you saw someone playing it, was perfect. But in reality, it was a deck with good and bad matchups, just like this deck. But yeah, people do need to learn the combo requirements to execute successfully, and it's pretty common for people to mess it up in paper if they don't understand these. Yeah.
Yeah, that Doomsday reference really speaks to me too. And I would also think of things like Mean Deck Tendrils and Vintage back in the day. These decks, which you can never quite tell if they actually were just completely busted and the mathematical or computational entry point was what was keeping people away, or if they were not actually that competitive compared to the rest of the format, but the fact that they did offer these puzzles you had to solve in real time, like that was the explicit appeal for many of the people who did pick those up.
Yeah, Doomsday is notoriously, I think, the most difficult thing that Magic has offered. I've played a lot of dumb combo decks over the years, and I think that the Doomsday Fetchland Tendrils deck was the only deck where I was just like, I think I am losing percentage by playing this deck just on virtue of like I going through and learning everything is just too much.
I suppose you get some flavor of that currently with like Modern Belcher with Across the Paths, where that decision tree is like orders of magnitude larger still. But yeah, anything in that space, I think, if you're wired a certain way, like those decks really do appeal to you.
They do, yeah. And I really appreciate the Belcher Discord that made a really extensive document explaining how all the lines work and how to play around the various things. And the combo lines for this deck are significantly simpler than that. Like that was like a 30-step process. This one is like a 10-step process, if that. Often it's like 5 steps. So it's much easier than that. But yeah, it is sort of in that ilk of decks with a lot of steps to executing the combo optimally.
Mm-hmm. So we will link some of those equivalent documents in the show notes there for people who want to study that on their own time. I think our time mostly is going to be better spent taking this kind of high-level view of the deck and then diving into some of these specific, you know, deck building and gameplay choices. But in terms of the actual comboing mechanics, what do you think are the big points that are still important to touch on here?
Okay, so how many minutes do you want me to spend on this? Because it sounds like we want to keep it on a little bit on the shorter side.
As many as you feel you need to do that justice.
Okay, got it. So in terms of comboing with this deck, the biggest quantum leap in technology for this deck was the addition of the Chain Veil. So the Chain Veil is an artifact that lets you activate the activatable abilities of your Planeswalkers an additional time this turn. And the way it is phrased is that it lets you activate the abilities of Planeswalkers even if they're not on the battlefield when the Chain Veil was there. And if you looked at this card and didn't think that was obvious, you are not alone. I have read the entire comprehensive rules, all 200 plus pages of them, twice, and this was not obvious to me because it looks like a continuous effect that blocks in the set of objects it applies to when it resolves, but it doesn't. And so when I first was told about the Chain Veil and how it made this deck very broken, I was like, what are you talking about? This deck doesn't even accomplish anything. But so that was a pretty significant leap for the deck, was the addition of the Chain Veil, which before, I'm told, because I'd never played the deck before the Chain Veil was added, you needed 14 Devotion and a Karn and a Cura in play and a Karn and Cura in your graveyard in order to full combo your opponent. But with the Chain Veil in your deck, this brings it down to just 8 Devotion. And so I'm going to step through the combo just very briefly for people who haven't seen it before. And then I'll talk about a couple major variations of that. I'm not going to talk about the exact amount of mana you need to have at each point. I'll just tell you like the major breakpoints you need to hit in order to combo. Does that sound okay?
Yeah.
That's great.
Okay. So the major version of the loop, so as I described before, so you have a Karn and Cura in play, a Karn and Cura in your graveyard, you have a Nykthos in play, and you have some amount of mana and some amount of devotion. And so the easiest version of this loop is where you activate Chain Veil exactly one time. So you fetch for the Chain Veil, you activate the Chain Veil, you then use Cura again to untap your Nykthos and make more mana. You'll then get Pestilent Cauldron from your sideboard, which is an artifact, but it is a sorcery on the other side that lets you regrow 2 planeswalkers, lands, or creatures, notably not artifacts and not enchantments. Lets you regrow 2 of these, and you can also you both players gain 4 life. And what you'll do is you'll regrow the cure, current cure in your graveyard. You'll play the new cure. You'll activate Nykthos twice for mana. You'll play the fresh Karn. This Karn can be activated twice. So you'll, on two different instances, you'll down ticket for Pestilent Cauldron as Restorative Burst, and you'll sort of repeat this loop. Players will gain life. You don't actually want to gain, in paper, you don't want to say I gain an unbounded amount of life. Like usually when I'm infinite comboing in paper, I say a Googleplex. It's, but here you actually want it to be a, like a finite smaller number, like 500. And so you'll repeat this process, netting mana and life for both players each time. And then at the end of this process, you're going to use your Karn to wish for a black source. I'll get into black sources later, but you get a black source of mana. You cast the front side of Pestilent Cauldron and you mill your opponent using the second activated ability of Pestilent Cauldron. And as a very minor technical note for it, like if you want to execute this combo on Modo effectively, what you want to do is you only need to gain like 12 or 16 life and activate Chainbell a couple extra times, and then you'll just cast Pestilent Cauldron, mill your opponent for like 12 or 16, and then you'll untap Cauldron with Cure repeatedly so you can mill them. So like realistically, you should be able to mill your opponent in 3 minutes, like full combo your opponent in 3 minutes on Modo. So like it should not take you 10 minutes. This should not happen if you practice even a small amount. You should practice like in the tournament practice room. But that's the combo. You activate Chainmail once, you burst back your Planeswalkers repeatedly, you gain mana, and then you mill your opponent.
Yeah, I will comment that I had originally played this deck before the Chainmail, and not only was it a huge upgrade in terms of mana, but the Magic Online clock required because of that untap line. Before the Chainmail, you didn't have that whole multiple activate Kiora thing, so you actually had to go the full 60, and it was a huge pain.
Oh, wow, that sounds awful.
Yeah.
I can understand why this deck saw even less play before the chain bill was added to it.
Well, so this leads to a question which maybe should not exist, but in some ways is one of the more interesting questions that the deck raises, is if you do find yourself under time pressure, like let's say you're in a three-game set against Blue-White Control or something, and you find this window to combo, but you are under time pressure, you need to get the job done quickly. Are there ways to kind of economize that time or use that more effectively in a way that maybe is not strictly theoretically optimal, but like actually given the constraints of the situation does the job?
So the other thing you can do is you can just sort of like make a bunch of mana and wish for your whole sideboard. I often find this kind of just takes longer than full comboing, because the thing is like, so when you're full comboing, like the first thing you can do is you make like 50 mana or whatever. So you make 50 mana, and then you don't even need to like use cure to make more mana additional loops. Like you just wish for burst repeatedly with Karn, and you can even just target nothing, because you'll have to discard to hand size if you wish too much back if you wish too much stuff back to your hand and pass the turn, like to deck them, you'll have to discard to hand size a bunch. So you just make a bunch of mana, you burst a bunch of times without getting anything back, because it'll still exile itself because it has no targets, but you chose it to have no targets, so keep exiling itself, you gain a bunch of life, and then you use Cura to deck them. Wishing for your sideboard actually usually takes quite a bit longer and is more click intensive, and you can do this pretty fast. Like for example, Stainerson, Tommy Ashton, he was in the showcase challenge at time of recording. This was a week ago. He was playing against Rastef, and he had 3 minutes and like 26 seconds on the clock, and he had to full combo his opponent, and he won with 3 seconds left on the clock. So you can do this pretty fast. Although to set yourself up for the ability to do this, you kind of just need to learn how to play fast. And so like I timed out before I learned all of these various tricks. I timed out probably like 5 or 6 times when I first started playing the deck, just because like I didn't understand yet both how to play it quickly and how to combo quickly. So you kind of just need to learn. You can do that in the tournament practice room, but it can be executed pretty quickly.
Let's get into some of the, I guess, the top level deck building choices here, because it feels like the majority of, certainly the spells in the main deck are pretty locked in. And I don't know if it makes sense to start with those, like that core of the deck. Do you think there's anything that is worth noting or that might not be immediately apparent to people about, you know, the 8 mana elves, the 4 old growth trolls, and everything else which you kind of take for granted there?
But all these cards are very good. Like with Magic, a lot of people try a lot of different things, but everyone has 4 copies of all these cards, except for one. But I guess I'll get into more later. But if you're not playing 4 QR, you're wrong. But you know, the 4 elves of the Elvish Mystic and Llanowar Elves variety. You got your 4 Oldgrowth Troll, 4 Cavalier of Thorns, 4 Kiora Behemoth Beckoner, 4 Karn, 4 Storm the Festival, 4 Oath, 4 Wolf Willow Haven. You should play 4 of all these cards. Like, these cards are great. And then after that, you have sort of 3 flex slots that two of them should be spells, and one can be usually another accelerant, or it could be a land, like a 20-second land. These decks usually play 21 lands. Sometimes you play 22. The thing about this deck, Magic players love to have agency over things. With this deck, you have very little flexibility in what you can put in your main deck. Like, all but two of your spell slots or three of your spell slots are 100% accounted for when you decide to play this archetype. And so you have almost no agency over how the deck gets built because so many of the slots are fixed. And it's kind of one of the things you got to accept when you're playing a deck is it's so good at executing the thing that it does that you will like make it worse if you cut any of these core cards.
Yeah, let's talk about that fourth Kiora then, because I agree with you that is a sacred cow that cannot be touched, but some people do seem to feel differently. So let's make the case as clear as it needs to be on why that fourth Kiora can't go anywhere.
I'm sure. So I would play a fifth Kiora before I played a third Kiora. And this actually comes into some of the other cards people might choose to play is it sort of fills in the role of a fourth Kiora. But Kiora does... it does several things that are good for the deck. It untaps stuff. So this is good when you, at the line I described before, you go turn two, Willful Haven, turn three, you go Kiora plus Old Growth Troll and draw a card. This is a really good turn three from a pretty pedestrian looking turn two. It doesn't require any Oath of Nissa shenanigans to be castable. It makes your Storm of the Festival much better because they draw cards. I mean, it's just a very good key card for the deck. And I guess if you've listened, once this podcast is done, if you were kind of listening, you listened to the full podcast and you didn't learn anything because you know more about Monogreen than I do, then do whatever you want. But if someone is listening to this podcast and they're getting value from the kinds of things that I'm telling you, I'm just going to say right now you should play the fourth Kiora, save yourself the trouble. Cause a lot of people have thought about this pretty hard and basically everyone's come to the conclusion that you want the fourth Kiora.
I think that is a good way to frame it, is if the four of deck building limit did not exist for this one specific card, how many copies would you see yourself playing? And I agree that it would be, I think the average correct numbers of Kiora would be more than four as opposed to less than four, regardless of what the top of that range might be. From the other side, I think this is a question that people encounter a lot, which is because Kiora has such a high starting novelty, if you're going to attempt to attack it down or kind of contain it in some way, that involves a real sacrifice in terms of the damage you could be doing to the opponent instead or developing your board optimally in some other way. How scared should someone be of just a Kiora that currently does not have, let's say, a Wolf Willow Haven land or a Nykthos to pair with it? And how would you tend to approach that decision from the other side of, you have a Dreadball as Rados midrange, for example. Are you just firing that off on Kiora if you get the opportunity, or are you saving it for something that is more overtly threatening?
Sure. So I guess it sort of depends on the amount of damage the deck is able to deal. Like, for example, a mono red deck, it's kind of hard for it to deal 27 damage. That's a lot of damage. Usually a deck that's can sort of just exactly get to the 20 finish line should probably not try to deal with Kiora. Whereas a deck that can, will beat you by an additional 20 damage, like say mono white, they should probably kill Kiora in most cases. And similarly with, it's like if someone's playing Rakdos and they have a Dreadboar, you should probably kill the Kiora because the plus cards of playing an Old Growth Troll or a Cavalier of Thorns is pretty devastating. Because even with nothing else, a turn three Kiora ramps into a turn four Cavalier of Thorns. And that's a pretty backbreaking sequence with nothing else happening before that. So if you're a deck that can win by 20 extra damage, you should kill Kiora. If you're not say mono red, you probably want to let it go.
And then I think the last remaining flex slots, so to speak, tend to revolve around the final land count. So I think 21 is the most common, but some people go down to 20 or up to 22. And then do you want the 13th or even 14th two mana accelerant? So, the first or second Sylvan Carriage, for example. Where do you fall on questions like that typically?
At this exact moment, so I've been playing Sylvan Carriage for the entire time. Right now, I actually play a 22nd land because the land kind of also has hexproof, and a lot of the times your land count is pretty low. Like the way I most frequently lose games is I have an opening hand that has exactly Nykthos as its land and nothing else. Then I mulligan, and then the 6-card hand has the exact same property, and then you go to 5 and you lose because you went to 5 cards. So that's why I'm up to a 22nd land, but I'm not completely confident on that. But I'm hesitant of playing a 3 action cards in those 3 flex slots and not having a land or a Caryatid as at least one of them. So I think you definitely want one of those flex slots to be mana. Should I talk about the other flex slots a little bit? So if you're expecting a lot of mono white, I think the flex slots I like the most, and I'm going to talk about it in this context of there being 2 flex slots because the last one's going to be mana of some sort. I think Tulsimir is really good. Tulsimir, Friend to Wolves, 2 green, green, white for a legendary elf, some other subtype. It's a 3-3, and then when a wolf enters the battlefield, you have it fight something and you gain 3 life, and it also makes a 3-3 legendary wolf called Voha. And it also trigger if you have wolves from Wolf Willow Haven enter the battlefield, so it also fight something, up to one thing, and gain you 3 life. I think this is the best flex slot against mono white specifically, because you want to like kill some of their stuff before they can overwhelm you and kill you in one hit with Brave the Elements. So the white splash, and that also gives you Portable Hole and Glass Cask on the sideboard, is one way you could build the deck. The white for Tulsimir specifically in the main deck. And I like the Tulsimir in the main deck even more than I like the white sideboard cards. And it also makes it a little easier to cast Teferi. You could also have Teferi in these flex slots. Teferi makes it trivial to combo from a very low base, but it has the property I'll talk about later about, you know, having off-colored mana symbols in it. There's been black splashes for Vraska as a Planeswalker, and that lets you have Fatal Push in the sideboard. You could also have, we'll talk about this a little bit later, I came up with adding Nicol Bolas to the deck. There's also Nissa Vital Force. This is the Nissa from Kaladesh that untaps to make your land into a 5/5 temporarily, or can regrow a permanent card or ultimate to let you draw a card whenever your land enters the battlefield. There's also War of the Spark Nissa that people might be more familiar with, the one who goes, the land will fight for us. I'm down on that one quite a bit. And there's also kind of meme-y ones like Ralzeric. In terms of fighting creatures that are just green, there's Pelucranos and Voracious Hydra. These do some pretty real things. And what I'm on right now in my flex slots is I have main deck Sky Sovereign, which is really good against red-black specifically.
Yeah, I've also been quite impressed by the Sky Sovereign against mono-white, where like picking off Brutal Cathar or something like that through Brave the Elements is nice, and then having that potential colorless blocker, again, through Brave, but also it just does a very good job at containing the kind of boards that can overwhelm you quickly, and that's a really nice way to use that flex slot, I think.
Yeah, I would like to just quickly chime in. What are your thoughts on the interactions of, like, how much does it matter that, like, with Voracious Hydra, that is not a hit off Storm the Festival? I know you have some strong opinions on, like, Fatal Push in that regard, but is there, like, a big pull toward something toward, like, Sky Sovereign or Pelucranos over Voracious Hydra for that reason?
So, Voracious Hydra definitely does something. I know some people really don't like Voracious Hydra because it's a bad hit off Storm the Festival, which is true, and it's also really good to draw. It also has a nice spell case if you can just play it as, like, green-green for 2 devotion, which is good. If you're on the play in the mirror, you can use it to fight down an opposing elf. Against a lot of decks, can be a pretty big threat. It can get Fatal Push, but often when you play against Rakdos, by the time you're, like, playing a big Voracious Hydra, often they've already used their push removal at that point, and so it'll often be able to successfully fight something. It's really bad against blue-white. It's really bad against blue-white specifically. But I can see playing Voracious Hydra. I mean, I played Voracious Hydra a bit. I think right now I gravitate a bit away from Voracious Hydra because the way that I most often lose games is not being able to storm successfully, and I'm ramping to, you know, 4 and 5 mana pretty reliably, so I expect to be able to cast other flex slots. But I think Voracious Hydra is, like, totally reasonable. I'm just right now more interested in making bigger hits off Storm. But I recommend to the audience to, like, try it and see how you feel about Voracious Hydra and, like, how much is it costing you in the games where it's a whiff off of Storm versus the games where it was very good that you drew it early and were able to fight something like an Elf in the Mirror or a key creature against Mono White earlier than other important things could have come down.
Yeah, I know that a month or two ago when the go-to anti-green decks, which we can debate how successful they were in that role, but stuff like Mono Blue Spirits or Boros Heroic, these small creature decks, which, you know, if you were able to pick off their creatures successfully with an early Voracious Hydra, that would often really swing the game in your favor. I think you see some of that dynamic again now with Mono White and some of the other ways to attack Mono Green, but if the format cycles back around to that point, which now that Rakdos is kind of everywhere as this litmus test, I don't know if it can, but if it does, then I think main deck Hydra probably will cycle back in again as well. Let's touch on these off-color planeswalkers then, because the whole saga of Nicol Bolas has been an interesting one to watch unfold, and you can take a lot of the credit there.
I suppose I can. I mean, with anything in Magic, it's very fraught to say you quote-unquote invented anything, because Magic is a game with so many people playing it, and so many people simultaneously come up with ideas. And my coming up with this idea is, in fact, derivative of someone else, but I can sort of tell the story of it. So where Nicol Bolas came from is other than it has a second line of text that says you can cast planeswalkers as though with mana as though it were of any color. And back in 2016 at GP Manchester, Raphael Levy had these two Chandra Flamecaller in his sideboard, in his green-white tokens deck that he could only cast off of four Oath of Nyssa. And everyone, you know, I guess before the tournament, you would have thought this is terrible. Like, why would you have this card in your deck? But it did some very specific things that he wanted, and he won the Grand Prix. I believe this didn't get very much press coverage at the time because there was simultaneously a GP in, I think, Minneapolis that same weekend in the U.S. And I think that one had video coverage. So the one in Europe had only text coverage, so this kind of went under the radar. Although I remember shortly thereafter, Frank Karsten, he wrote an article about it saying he sort of ran the numbers on how likely you were to be able to cast it. And he said, you know, you weren't an overwhelming favorite to be able to cast it. But if it was, you know, X percent better than the next best option, then it could make sense to play it. And so
just to jump in, as I recall, the outcome of that tournament was also overshadowed by another event that happened in that building, which was Fabrizio getting disqualified, which then opened up the GP Master Race, which BBD won, which then led to him getting qualified for Worlds, which he won. And so there's this whole butterfly effect that rippled throughout the universe from that one moment. And so I think that was the lasting memory of that tournament, more so than Raf winning yet another GP with a fairly unconventional choice. But go back to what you were saying.
Yeah, for sure. I've forgotten about that. Yeah, that was another noteworthy event that happened at the time that sort of overshadowed it. And so only people who were really paying attention at this moment, you know, 6 years ago, would have noticed this is a thing that happened and then proceed to think about it. And so, you know, I've been playing Magic for a long time. This is one of the things that's in my arsenal of techniques to try. And so I was thinking, I really wish I had a Planeswalker against Blue-White. Like, actually, specifically, I was thinking I wanted the 6-mana uncounterable Chandra against Blue-White because I, like, wanted a better hit, or better card to cast that would just kind of, like, really seal the game against them. And so I was, you know, I was talking to my friend group about it, and I was like, we could have a Planeswalker of literally any color because we have Storm the Festival and we have Oath of Nyssa, and we can also Storm into Oath of Nyssa and, like, cast the Planeswalker. So, like, we can play basically, like, any Planeswalker we want, as long as it costs less than 6 mana. Like, the actual Chandra sort of didn't pan out as an idea because we really want to be able to storm into it. And so we went through every Planeswalker you conceivably cast, like, regardless of colored symbols, what is the best thing you could have in this slot? And the idea was Nicol Bolas, Dragon God. So I came up with this idea. This was June 21st, and I tried it. And the very first game in the league I tried it, I cast it on turn 4. I would have had it on turn 3, but my opponent, like, killed my elf. But I played it on turn 4 and, like, won that game. And I was like, you know, this is actually pretty good when it's on the battlefield, because I wanted a card that would be good against Blue-White, that could kill a Teferi on 5 loyalty, that could make card advantage, that would help me combo. It does, like, a lot of things really well. And so I tried to test Nicol Bolas. Everyone's very skeptical, because you should always be skeptical of, like, ideas that radically sort of change the deck. But we tried it. It does a lot of stuff pretty well. It sort of stayed under wraps a bit until a friend did well at an RCQ with it. He posted about it on Twitter. It made the rounds among the a lot of players who were based in Japan. And then I think Telco was the first person to get a Moto list published with it the day after Slater tweeted about it. And then it sort of entered into the Magic hive mind. And so once you have Nicol Bolas in the deck, then now the floodgates are open. Like, you could choose to try literally any Planeswalker regardless of colored mana symbols in it. It's, like, a lot of optionality. And so the one that the hive mind seems to settle on now is Teferi Who Slows the Sunset, which I would not have come up with if I was, like, looking through the list of Planeswalkers that you could play. But this is sort of the evolution of Magic ideas, is you have some base idea, you sort of iterate on it, and you get to something you know, more interesting. But that is the saga of Nicol Bolas.
Yeah, I do appreciate the context of, like, once you have tried Nicol Bolas, it's not going to get any harder than full-on Grixis mana, so everything else has to be a little more achievable.
Yes, and with Teferi, you can sometimes sort of backdoor your way into casting it, but for the most part, you sort of need to, like, Storm or hit Oath of Nyssa. And I guess this gets me to a point about sort of the off-color Planeswalkers. Is initially, I thought I had this idea of Nicol Bolas, and I was like, this is great. Like, we can cast two Nicol Bolas in our deck. This is amazing. And then, you know, the more you play with the card, the more, like, you get stuck with the Nicol Bolas in your hand and you can't cast it. And that's a pretty bad fail case. So it needs to be, like, enough better than what the replacement value would be enough of the time that you can justify having this uncastable card in your deck. And so I've actually now come pretty far down on the off-color Planeswalkers, despite having come up with it in the first place. And so this can change depending on the meta or other factors. But my advice to the audience is you should have a really, really high bar for putting the off-color Planeswalkers in your deck, because when you can't cast it because you either didn't draw an Oath of Nyssa, or, like, the Blue-White player played Farewell and got rid of your Oath, and so now you can't cast it anymore even though you found one, You'll often, not always, but often lose a game off the back of having an uncastable card in your hand. Like, an uncastable card is a really big deal. And so whenever you're thinking, oh, I can just, you know, play this off-color Planeswalker and it's free, I'd give the advice to the audience of be very critical of choosing to include the off-color Planeswalkers in your deck or not, and make sure that they're justifying their inclusion, because it's not free.
The Nicol Bolas also seem to fill this quite specific role, which I think speaks to a larger point about the mono-green mirror, or I guess the four-color ramp mirror, if you go by MTG Goldfish designations, which is that there are a lot of games in the mirror which are just these boring shit shows of, it's a combo ramp mirror, right? I'm on the play, I have my ideal start, I just run you over. But then there's this subset of games, and I don't know how common they even are, where like the board stalls out because both players have Cavaliers and Old-Growth Trolls and so on, and no one can really make attacks. And then, you know, you have like both players' Khans are shut off because one Khan got Pithing Needle for the opposing Khan and so on. And you get into these quite obscure, long games where you have to find quite specific ways to break through that stalemate. And Nicol Bolas as a way of stealing the loyalty abilities of other Planeswalkers without being named Khan the Great Creator, like, gave you this theoretical way to bob and weave around that. And so it seems like that dynamic, now that people have moved away from Nicol Bolas, isn't really in play anymore. But
sure, when I added Nicol Bolas to the deck, it was mostly to be specifically for blue-white as an answer to Teferi. And it does some stuff in the mirror that's nice, but then you also sometimes you can't cast it because the games in the mirror, they end really quickly, like turn four, turn five. Some small fraction of games go past turn six. Like, they end really fast. So if you have an uncastable card, that's like quite bad. And so I don't view Nicol Bolas as the mirror as a reason to include Nicol Bolas. I actually would go so far as to say that I actually don't advocate for making literally any main deck concessions to your deck, or in terms of deck building, make any changes to your main deck for the mirror, because a huge fraction of the games of the mirror pre and post board will mostly just be determined by the shuffler. Ramp mirrors in general tend to be pretty low agency. And so I think it is a spew of win percentage points to make any changes to your deck based on what you expect to face in the mirror. Because sort of no matter what you put in the bullet slots, usually one person will just not draw the other, and the person on the play is a pretty significant advantage. And so there's kind of not much you can really do about that. And I don't view the mirror as a reason to include Nicol Bolas in the deck.
Do you have any suggestions on how to influence a shuffler to rig those odds in your favor?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
we can circle back to perhaps a more productive conversation then. So the point you made about Storm the Festival and wanting more kind of big hits for that in the deck initially, one thing that scared me off embracing Mono Green, and I don't know if that was how incorrect our judgment was in retrospect, was that it felt like the deck had to be built in a certain way in order to enable Storm the Festival, but that just the odds of actually, you know, your expected yield from that, depending on how contextually strong a Khan was, for example, or, you know, an Old-Growth Troll or something, it felt like the expected outcome was not where it needed to be in order to justify spending six mana to spin the wheel sometimes. And so now that we have these options like, you know, the various different Nissas, or Sky Sovereign is a good example too, those juice the numbers in a way that I think does make that more palatable sometimes. But with a card where the variance is so overt, in the moment, how do you weigh up, should I be spinning the wheel on Storm versus taking a line with a more deterministic output, if that makes sense?
Sure. My advice to the audience would be, if you have the option between Storm or some reasonably good play, I actually would say you should not play Storm the Festival. You should play the other card. I think regardless of how much you're playing Storm the Festival, you should probably cast it less and cast something more deterministically better more often than you currently are, for however often you are casting Storm right now. Because it's pretty frequent that you'll like cast a Storm and you could like, you know, hit, you know, 2-5 drops and you'll be really happy and you're like, oh, this is great, you know, I'm winning, the game is over. But it's also pretty easy if you just hit 5 bricks, like, you know, lands, Wolf Willowhaven, like you can brick. And if you just cast like a Cavalier of Thorns or like a Cure and a Troll and like Storm the next turn, this also sets you up to have a better Storm the following turn, because then you could like have more mana available to hit a Nykthos and activate it, or more mana floating to, you know, do stuff with. And so something that took me a while to realize is I should just cast Storm the Festival less. Like, unless I'm very behind and need a very good Storm hit to win, if I'm in a game that's going okay, I'll just not cast the Storm and cast what's in my hand. And I found I started winning a lot more when I started doing that. So I would advise to cast stuff in your hand over Storm more. But and then but once I started doing this, then also you kind of hit Nicol Bolas less because you're like doing other stuff first. But I guess by the advice I have around that is just to cast stuff before Storm more and more frequently if the game allows it.
How much are some of these other deck building choices downstream of considering Storm the Festival? So under advice to audience in our notes here, you put do not play Fatal Push in your Storm the Festival deck. And in the debate over the relative merits of these different splashes, we need to think about the black splash versus the white splash, where you have Portable Hole often in a roughly approximate or equivalent role to Fatal Push, but how much is the fact that you can hit Portable Hole off your Storm the Festival moving the needle there?
That is certainly a bit of a consideration. I, for the most part, am not ever looking to board in the white artifact removal sideboard cards. If you do board them in, you kind of need a lot of white mana in your deck. Like Tolsimir, it's a 5-drop and you need a single white symbol, so you don't need that much white mana. But if you expect to reliably cast a 1 or 2 mana white card on curve, you need to add a lot of white mana to your deck, which then dilutes your forest count pretty significantly for Old World Troll, because you don't really want to go below, ideally 13, but definitely don't go below 12 forest type cards in this deck. So I don't view the ability to hit the white removal with Storm the Festival as a draw for the white, because I don't really ever intend to board it in, but boarding in cards that do not get hit by Storm is a very strong knock against them. That's why, like, the original idea I had for Oathness of Chandra, Uncounterable Chandra, didn't work, because like you just need to be able to hit Storm the Festival. So when you're constructing your deck, you should try to only have cards that are hits for Storm the Festival in your deck.
I guess this is a good bridge into the discussion about the whole sideboard, because a lot of these sideboards don't, they look like, you know, 15 cards that you would never actually bring in. So I guess sort of to break that down, what are the cards that should never be cut? What are the cards that are sort of important in certain spots? And what cards do you actually put in the deck at various points?
Sure. So I guess the highest tier of cards that's definitely never getting cut, these are just cards that fundamentally allow your deck to operate the way it needs to. Pestilent Cauldron, you know, and the Chain Veil, these are just part of your combo. You can never cut these cards. So those are two. Sky Sovereign is so good against red black. Like, you just go like Karn, get Sky Sovereign, the game is kind of over. And there's just so many spots where Sky Sovereign is just the king of the format, the king of the battlefield, the king of the sky, I guess, because it's Sky Sovereign. But Sky Sovereign is just an amazing card. Meteor Golem, it's like outs to permanence. I remember there was this period where LSV would like sneak a Karn into every standard deck he was playing, no matter how inappropriate it was, because he's like, oh, you know, outs to permanence. But Meteor Golem is outs to permanence, and it just answer anything. So Meteor Golem, I would have put in that tier. And then a black source of mana. We can maybe go down the meme rabbit hole about what counts as a black source. Almost anything counts as a black source of mana in this deck, especially if you have a Nicol Bolas, because it lets your Nykthos tap for devotion to black. But you should have a black source in your deck. And when I say this, I do not count Treasure Vault. You should not put Treasure Vault in your deck if it's to be there as a black source. So I'd also count in this sort of great tier is Darksteel Citadel. Just like a land to get for Karn. Because like when your Karn often won't get a land, but when you do get a land, you like really need that land. Like you need that more than anything else, because you had, you know, up to 14 other targets you could have gotten with your Karn and you got a land. So you really don't want it to get like abraded. There's like things that can kill an artifact in this format. So you should also have a land in your sideboard when you really need it. So those are like the things I would say are like really at the tippity top. And then there's other cards which we'll go to in a second that are also pretty good, but these are the ones I could like kind of never really imagine cutting.
That all checks out. The Meteor Golem thing is really interesting to me, because that seems like almost like there's interchangeable ways to handle permanence that might not cost 7 mana, but I guess it is the one card that answers everything regardless of what it is.
Yeah, when you've got like, to some extent, sideboard slots are both valuable and not valuable at all, but if you can get rid of significant problems that exist on the board, you know, many types of problems with one card, this is often a sign that the card should like be in your sideboard. So yeah, Meteor Golem is, you know, it's outs to permanence. Everybody loves outs to permanence.
I guess approaching that from the other direction, because with a lot of decks, there's this inbuilt assumption that those sideboard slots are inherently valuable, and that, you know, having even going back to the early days of Companions, where there was this debate over, like, is this even better than having the 15th sideboard card? And the answer invariably there is yes. But with a Tarn deck, you now have that discussion for basically every single sideboard slot of, do I want to enhance my Karn toolbox with this, or do I want to have a card here that I can sideboard in for given matchups or situations? So, for example, the Voracious Hydras, which some people have main deck, some people just have those in the sideboard and bring them in as required. Where do you fall on the value of being able to sideboard versus just have, you know, 15 cards in the Karn toolbox and calling it a day?
I think I normally have between 13 and 15 bullets in my sideboard. If you are playing this deck, you're going to spend a lot of time thinking about what the 13th, 14th, and 15th best artifacts in Pioneer are and talking about that with your friends. But the flip side of that is there's very few deck building choices to make. Like, there's, you know, two or three main deck slots, depending on, you know, how you feel about the various flex slots. And then there's usually no more than three or five cards you'll be thinking about for the sideboard. So, With this deck, you'll spend a lot of time thinking about what the, you know, nth best artifact in Pioneer is. But I'll usually play somewhere between zero and two, like, quote unquote, real sideboard cards.
And then moving beyond that top tier to the ones which I guess theoretically are optional, but in practice you see them in basically every sideboard. Pithing Needle, which has a lot of applications, you know, in the mirror across the board. And then what are some of the common named cards, I suppose, in the most important matchups?
Sure. So for Pithing Needle against red-black, you'll very commonly name Liliana. That's a pretty common name. Against blue-white, you're going to name either Teferi or the Wandering Emperor. A pretty frequent line is you'll, like, if you have creatures you want to attack with, you might even pre-combat your Karn and then just play Needle out without them having either Planeswalker on the board and just name the Wandering Emperor just so you can attack without fear. But yeah, Teferi and the Wandering Emperor. And against blue-white, they're going to pretty frequently exile your Needle, but your Karn could just immediately wish for it back out of the Farewell Exile Zone or the Portable Hole Exile Zone. So it's pretty sticky against blue-white. And then I'd say the next most common thing that it names is Baseju against specifically Hidden Strings. This is different now that red-black is out and you name Liliana against them very frequently, but for the most part, I actually viewed Pithing Needle to be stapled together with Damping Sphere for the Hidden Strings matchup, and there you would name Baseju. Although this has gotten a little bit worse because now they also play two Odawara in addition to three Baseju. But I think those are the most frequent things: is Baseju against Hidden Strings, Teferi, the Wandering Emperor, and Liliana. And then also in the mirror, you might need little opposing Planeswalkers, but that also can make things a little awkward for you. But you do it. We got to do in the mirror.
Yeah, Damping Sphere was a card I actually was beginning to question if I could use that slot more effectively, because it seemed like it was only really targeted at Hidden Strings, Lotus Field, which does not really exist at this point, as far as I can tell. And to the extent that it does, you still win a lot of those games just by Needle on stage, or by, you know, getting Godfather Statue the next turn, or just going off faster than them. But then the counter argument I heard was that there are times in the mirror, which is a crucial matchup, where you get to a point where you're ahead and have Karn, but can't, like, fully go off, and being able to curtail their Nykthos responses with your Damping Sphere ends up being pretty important. Does that check out for you?
Yeah, and this is a situation that can come up when, like, you have Karn, but they have Nykthos, and so then you'll want a Damping Sphere. It's sometimes, you know, you do what you gotta do. I think this is one of the weaker sideboard slots. Like, I could see cutting it. This is classic confirmation bias, although as soon as you cut it, you will immediately face Hidden Strings. And so I think this is one of the slots that could go. And it's not, this one's not set in stone.
Going down the list then, we have a Tormod Crypt, which when Phoenix was a more popular deck, like, this was a pretty common first thing to get there. And then it really helps to put the squeeze on Greasefang, where they have to deal with a Karn, but they also can't kind of go through Karn with something like a Sky Sovereign, and you can sweep up their graveyard from there. And then one card which I think has mostly solidified itself now is Transmogrifying Wand, which had very specific targets in mind. So against, you know, against Phoenix, if to kill a Thing in the Ice, for builds that were playing that, or against Heroic, you know, you could deal with their Virtuoso or whatever their biggest threat had become. What are some of the more common applications of that card these days?
So I think it's actually gotten a little bit worse over time, but there was a period where almost no one was playing Transmogrifying Wand, and I was so happy that it hadn't caught on widely yet, because I was getting a lot of value out of it. But so as you mentioned, Ledger Shredder and Thing in the Ice, it does a great job against those. Against Heroic, It's really good at killing their creatures because it's a colorless ability, and so it gets past all the God's Willing type effects. Against red-black, it kills Kalidus or Shieldred. Let's see what else. Niv, it kills Niv. There's also, it used to be that we would play as a black source, we'd have Overgrown Tomb and we'd fetch it with Golos, but sometimes you might mill the Overgrown Tomb, and so what you would do then is you would Transmogrifying Wand, you would kill your own Cavalier of Thorns to put it on top of your deck, and then you could just draw it or fetch it with Golos. And there's actually some interesting sort of situation you can get in where you like wand your own stuff to then like exile it from your graveyard or put it back in your library and like loop it in that way. But it's the thing that Wand does is it is the most disruptive card you can play against singular threats for 4 mana. Like, at 5 mana, you have Sky Sovereign, and 7 mana, you have Meteor Golem. But at 4 mana of like, 3 to play and 1 to activate, it's kind of the most disruption you can do. Plus, if you ever like, if you have 5 mana and you like play it, kill something, cure, untap it, that's just full combo deck where you don't kill 2 things for 5 mana. That's when you're truly playing a combo deck.
It also feels like a hard removal spell for the most part, because the 2/4 Ox is just so irrelevant in the face of, Troll, Cavalier, and so on. Like, it's very easy to invalidate that body.
To quickly loop back to Tormod's Crypt, has there been any consideration to, I believe Lantern of the Lost is the, it like exiles itself and exiles graveyards, or is just the 0 mana effect more important than potentially looping it back another time with Karn?
The 0 mana matters a lot when you need it, specifically against Phoenix. Against Greasefang, I actually don't think that Crypt is that important, because often with your Karn, you should actually just plus, because they could still, say, get back Seekus Chariot and they have the cats, but they can't crew any of their vehicles. And so the 0 mana really matters a lot against Phoenix when they're on the turbo pieces of the puzzle delve plan, where you can just play it and get their graveyard immediately, or you play it past the turn and then make sure that they, instead of exiling immediately, make sure that they don't have the ability to get back any Arc-like Phoenixes from their graveyard, even though it might cost you the ability to let them delve, because then you'll have like an active card against a tapped out opponent. So the zero mana really matters a lot with Tormod's Crypt.
Okay, that checks out. I guess you mentioned a Seekus Chariot. That is a card that is almost ubiquitous in the sideboards here. You mentioned Sky Sovereign as like already being a vehicle that you would Karn for a lot of the time. When are you getting Chariot over Sky Sovereign?
I get Chariot most frequently, I'd say, against blue-white. Because it's often the first Karn target I get, because you want to get something that you can use to like pressure the planeswalkers that haven't hit the battlefield yet, but will, so you want to like play Chariot pretty immediately. You also get it a lot against Rakdos, or just when it can stabilize the board. The way the contours a lot of the aggro decks targeting beating mono-green work now is oftentimes the bodies aren't as good as they used to be. There's a period when they were pretty good. I think they're a little bit worse now, because all the tribal decks got so big with the lords from New Dominaria United. But when like you have 4 mana and you need the bodies, the Chariot is pretty good. I get it most frequently though against blue white, but it's in a pretty high tier of not getting cut anytime soon. But it is mostly there for blue white is when I get it most frequently. Some people also board it in. I'm not a huge fan of boarding it in. I am a fan of playing multiple Sky Sovereigns, depending on the metagame you expect, but I don't think I'd ever play multiple Chariots, and I don't really board the Chariot in.
I think the last card you have in this category is Ratchet Bomb, which feels sort of narrow, but it does have a pretty interesting application. I think it was one of the more recent additions to the deck.
Yeah, it's for creativity, for hitting the treasures and the tokens against that deck, because that deck, it can kind of just like go faster than you. Like, even if you have Karn to shut down the treasures, they just need like 5 mana, and they attack you for 30 damage with a combination of What's the god's name? Xenagos and World Spine Worm. And there, they can just kill you so fast you sort of want access to a cheap answer.
One recent candidate, which I think the jury still seems to be out on, is Karn Silex, which to some extent overlaps with Ratchet Bomb's functionality, but not really. But then you can imagine like doing more things with it, and it also winning games that no other card really could from those spots. So where do you fall on that at this stage?
There are definitely some games where it's really good. But there's also, like, you'll blow up a lot of your own stuff, too, frequently. I tried it. Other people that I respect their opinions of, they tried it. On the whole, everyone's sort of been pretty medium on it. So right now, I'm not a fan of Karn Silex. But my confidence in that statement is still pretty low. Like, there's only, so many dozens of games it could come up in yet.
There are also some of these fringe combo possibilities where you've seen some of these puzzles posted to Twitter of, you know, if you had any access to any Pioneer legal artifact, you know, could you find a line to win from this spot? So stuff like bronze cudgels comes to mind, or ancestral statue, things like this, where in theory, in some like very small percentage of games, these will open up combo lines that would not be available otherwise. But it seems like those don't come up frequently enough to be worth one of those 15 cyber slots.
Yeah, I'm pretty dubious of these cards. If there's a lot of artifacts in Pioneer, I think there's somewhere around like 700 or so. So you can go pretty deep going through the full list of artifacts. I think right now the sideboard covers basically all the major situations. But I guess anything is possible. It does seem like these Twitter puzzles, bronze cudgels basically always gets you there. So there could be something there. But I think the sideboard as a whole sort of covers everything pretty well.
And then I guess finally on the Khan sideboard point, you have the, what is it, like dozen different options for which meme black source you want to satisfy that requirement?
There's a lot, yeah.
Do you have any stance on which of those is actually worth playing, or does it really not matter which you pick?
I think realistically, it doesn't really matter what black source you play. If I was playing in paper, I think the one I might play is Secret Door, which lets you pay mana to venture into the dungeon, and so you could make treasure, but you could also make your opponent sacrifice all their creatures, discard all their cards, and then like lose a bunch of life if you go through the dungeon correctly, and then you could like sacrifice the token that you make. If I owned a beta JM Daytome, I would play that in a Nicol Bolas. But realistically, the one I've been playing the most is Navigator's Compass. It's a one mana artifact that lets you gain 3 life and it turns a land into a swamp, which is your black source. So often, like against one of these hyper aggro decks, if you can just gain 3 life because you have 1 spare mana with a Karn, you'll kill them the next turn. That can be good enough to win a game. And that's what I'm kind of looking for in a black source, is something that could make a percentage point change in a matchup that would be otherwise bad. And the other most common one is Reckoner Bankbuster, because it makes a treasure because you can untap it with Cure multiple times. That one, the argument is that you might draw cards with it, but it's, in terms of playing against, say, like blue-white, where I most want to draw cards, it's like the sixth thing I would tutor for, where I would get Chariot first, then I would often get Pestilent Cauldron or Sky Sovereign, then I'd get Pithing Needle, then I'd get whichever one of those 4 cards has been exiled so far, and then the sixth one I would get is the Reckoner Bankbuster, because it still gets owned by Farewell like anything else, and doesn't pressure that effectively. So I'm not a huge fan of Reckoner Bankbuster, but depending on the matchups you expect, it could be good. But right now, I play Navigator's Compass, and that's an idea from Gavin Thompson, Alpha Frog.
So I think with that, let's get into some of the matchups you can expect to face. And the mirror is one of those, but as we covered, there's really not much else to be said about that. And a lot of it is out of your control. Against Rakdos, it feels like there is a lot more that's in your control and a lot more that, yeah, I think this is the matchup where the way you sequence things, the way you expose your threats and so on does matter a lot. So what are some of the kind of common heuristics or decision points there?
Sure. So against Rakdos, if specifically, like this will be true in the post-war game where you know you're playing against Rakdos, but if you know you're playing against him in game one, the same heuristic applies. You should try to keep basically any hand with 7 cards in it. I'll give an example of this from a different format. At GP Vancouver in 2017, I was playing Amulet Titan against Jund. I think I was 8-1 at this point, or 9-1. And I was on the play and I kept a hand of a 1-mana Accelerant and 6 lands. And I knew my opponent was Jund and I kept this hand. And I won after I could play my Accelerant turn 1. They thought seized me. They saw 6 lands. And I proceeded to like win the match 2-0 very easily. And a spectator behind me just absolutely lost it when they saw the hand that I had kept. And they like started like berating me like right in the middle of the game. It was like at one of the top tables. And like I had to have a judge remove them. But against a Jund style deck with a ramp style deck, you should just keep any 7 card hand. Because if you mulligan, you're going to be like down a card. And they're still going to have the thought seize and removal spells for you. Liliana makes this angle a little bit worse, but not by much. So for the most part, if you have a even somewhat functional 7 card hand, you should try to keep it. And this is especially true post board because they have to dilute their clock by so much to bring in all the interactive spells that they want to bring in. Depending on their draw, for most games, they'll actually clock you very slowly, so you have time to draw out of it. So if you have a even somewhat functional hand, you should basically just keep any 7 cards.
Yeah, that's one thing that I think has changed in Modern against the Thoughtseize decks, with decks like Amulet on the whole, where now those decks are also applying pressure quickly enough that you can't really afford to have a subpar hand that is also getting a card strip from it, and you almost do have to mulligan aggressively in search for a hand that has several different things going for it at once. But it sounds like that isn't the case against this Black Red Deck and Pioneer, where there you know, if they're disrupting you, they're probably not clocking you as much, and their clock isn't that fast in the first place.
Yeah, and I'll give one more example here. This is probably the most extreme example. I was playing a game of, you know, green against black red, and my opponent was on the play. They had a turn three Liliana. This Liliana was on the battlefield the entire time from turn three until turn 17. It plused many times and ultimated at least once, and I had basically nothing the entire game. But their hand was literally, what they drew was literally all just answer cards. Eventually, I, like, you know, drew enough lands and then played threats and it killed them. So this is a little bit of an extreme example, but their clock is very slow. So you should just try to keep functional hands. And the other major point here is, so post-board, they often have four extinction events. This is a fairly recent development. And extinction event is very good against you. Like, this is kind of like their one trick, but it's an extremely good trick. And so what I found to be a good re-trick to this is in the 75 having three Sky Sovereigns. So that in post-board games, you can board up to two in the main deck and still have one to wish for with Karn. Because Sky Sovereign, they have almost no way to answer it once it's on the battlefield. And so if you have Sky Sovereign, you're going to kind of just destroy them. Especially because even if they kill your creatures, you could, like, take Cruel Lair of the Hydra and attack with it, and you'll kill, you know, their Liliana and their, you know, small creature. And so I like the three Sky Sovereign package against Black Red. I think it's really hard to lose even like a single game against Black Red. I mean, it still happens because, you know, you mulligan and, you know, they take your cards. But three Sky Sovereign I found to be extremely effective against Black Red post board.
I've seen some suggestions of having additional Azekah's Chariots to bring in against the Extinction Event plan, where you now have this card that generates this widespread of even CMC threats. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm more of a fan of the Sky Sovereign thing. This is an idea I came up with. I mean, I come up with a lot of bad ideas for this deck. This is an idea I came up with like 2 weeks ago, and it worked out pretty well in the showcase challenge where I went 7-2, Andrew Ellibogan went 6-3, and then Tommy Ashton made top eight of, you know, the Moto event, like, because like he does in every event. So he went 8-1. So we went a combined 21-6. And so I think it's worked out pretty effectively. And Sky Sovereign is like the best possible card you could have against red black. And so I would rather have more Sky Sovereigns before I had more Azekah's Chariots. And similarly, when you're playing the games, like, you should pretty aggressively Karn downtick for Sky Sovereign, even if it means your Karn is dying, because the Sky Sovereign, for the most part, can just coast to coast your black red opponent.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like Mono Green has maybe more variation than any other deck in terms of how well it performs on a given weekend. So you mentioned that showcase challenge where there were three Mono Green decks in the top eight, and then Batu Tinia, who won that event, was in the top eight of the next challenge. And then I saw someone say that, you know, it's a sign of how much things can change that the next week they played the 75 card mirror of Batutinia's list that they had copied themselves in the 0-2 bracket. And it feels like you see these events where Mono Green is dominating everything, and then you see the challenges the following weekend where, you know, you have to go pretty far down the top 32 to even find a copy there at all, versus a deck like Black Red or Blue Eye Control or something, which seems like it has a pretty consistent representation. Do you have any thoughts on why that might be, other than we're looking at a small sample and things like that happen sometimes, or is there actually something there?
I think there's a couple competing effects here. Like, the sample is somewhat small, but also the number of people playing Mono Green is not that large, and then the fraction of people who are playing it extremely well is going to be a bit smaller than that. There's just sort of like natural variance, and also people can change sort of like how hard they're targeting Mono Green. Like, if everyone's playing Mono Blue Spirits, then you're just going to lose if you're playing Mono Green. That's kind of just reality. But for the most part, I mostly attribute it to some amount of variance and some amount of metagame shifts. I think the deck is one of the tent poles of the format. It's like this deck and Rakdos. And so it being a good deck, like, in a vacuum, is not really going anywhere. And so it also can't really change very much. So the format sort of is the one thing that moves around it. But I think I mostly attribute it to variance.
You mentioned against Black Red, possibly boarding out some number of, you know, Llanowar Elves and Elvish Mystic. You can see the contextual reasons to do that against Black Red. It seems like in general the deck is built in a way that relies on having those starts fairly consistently, or like the mana base, for example. Like, if you couldn't rely on having or rely on untapping with Llanowar Elves a decent amount of the time, you would have to build the mana base and structure it differently, play more lands potentially. So is this just a matchup specific thing, or are there matchups where, you know, the elf is just like the natural thing to cut to do something else?
If I had two, like, cards that were reasonable to bring in my sideboard, I would board out two elves against both Black Red and Blue White for kind of the same reason, but also different reasons. Against Black Red, they're going to kill your elf. That's kind of just reality. But we have this dynamic I mentioned before where they've diluted the ability in their deck to clock you pretty significantly. And so you just have time to play lands and cast your spells. And so the elf is kind of the worst mana source because it doesn't have hexproof the way your forests kind of functionally do. And then against blue-white, you're going to play elves, but like they're going to get wrath. Like they're going to wrath, you know, one or two or three times, and your elves are like just worse forests. So I'd rather just kind of have more threats against blue-white and just very aggressively take lands over elves with my Oaths of Nissa. So for blue-white, for the same reason, because I guess we'll talk about this matchup in a second, but you're just going to jam threats every turn if you can, and you just want as much threat density as possible, and so you don't want mana sources that die to a wrath pretty easily.
Yeah, my question was, as to keeping basically anything, are there limits to that related to being light on mana sources? Because it seems like one of the ways that this, like, keep any 7-card hand could go awry is if you just don't get to do anything, or does the Rakdos deck generally just give you enough time to clear through that?
Sure, when I say keep anything, so, I mean, most of the cards in this deck are functionally mana sources. I mean, your lands are mana sources, right? Your Elvish Mystics and your Land of War Elves are mana sources. Your Willful Haven is usually your best mana source against these decks because it can't interact with once on the battlefield. I also tend to count Oath of Nissa as a significant fraction of a mana source. So these are all what I say when I mean mana sources. And so usually when you look at a hand, you're like, should I mulligan or not? Your hand might have one like card with the type land on it, but it could have five mana sources. I guess Cure also, if you have at least, you know, two mana sources, will also count as a mana source. And so if your hand is mostly mana sources, I'll tend to keep it. Against blue-white specifically, if it's an elf-heavy hand, I am quite a bit down on that. Like elves are the cards you kind of want to see the least against blue white. Against black red though, I think that keep any functional hand card counts. I mean, I don't count like Nykthos and no other lands, but if you've got like forest and like three other mana sources, you're probably keeping that even if none of the other ones are lands.
Yeah, the black red matchup seems like it's changed in two key ways with Dominaria, where the first is that Kalidas has mostly been etched out in favor of Shieldred, which I have to imagine is good news for the black-red deck, because Kalidas, you know, disabling Old Growth Troll and Cavalier of Thorns on the back end was one of the ways I found I was losing that matchup previously. But then also the addition of Liliana, which is kind of unclear what that does for the deck in the format at large. What does it do in this matchup, would you say?
In this matchup, it does give them more of an ability to cheese you out, where, you know, you have an elf, they kill it, you play an elf, they Liliana you, and that's kind of the entire game. Because then your entire hand could be, like, cards that are, like, too expensive to cast. The flip side is it's also something that you can, like, Karn and Needle Liliana, and they don't have that many answers, main or side, to Pithing Needle, so you can answer Liliana pretty effectively that way. But it can lead to quite a few non-games. But then you also have games like the one I described where there's a Liliana from like turn 3 to turn 17 and I still won. But it definitely is better for black-red to have Liliana than to not have Liliana. Because now I cannot depend on them just having like all answer cards in their deck and very few ways to clock me. And the cards, and it's very hard for them to reduce the raw count of cards in my hand by a lot. So I can just expect to, you know, be able to draw out of it. Liliana cuts that angle off quite a bit, but not entirely. So it does make the matchup better for black red.
I think the other big one to touch on is Blue Eye Control, which is a deck that it seems like gets quite little press relative to how consistently well it does in basically every large Pioneer tournament. And it's also a matchup where I think you'll see a big difference between how well good mono green players or experienced ones perform versus how well someone who just is picking up the deck for the first time might. So what would your advice be there?
Sure, I can give some specific advice for the blue-white matchup. This is a matchup I actually think is quite good for mono-green. I'm pretty happy to face it, and that also has a lot to do with kind of how you play the matchup. And so I started talking about boring out the elves a little bit because you want more stable mana sources. The way this matchup plays out is on turn three, they can kind of only have a three-mana counterspell. They can't have a card draw spell, and then turn four afterwards, they could have the Wandering Emperor or Memory Deluge or a counterspell or any, you know, number of other things. And so often you don't want to play something that gets totally owned by a three mana counterspell on turn three, but then from turn four onward, you just jam like your threats every turn. And you have a lot of resiliency to your threats. Your threats are pretty sticky. The card that you most need to be aware of is Farewell, because it quote unquote answers everything. And so if you can help it, you want to have one or two planeswalkers on the battlefield through Farewell, and you don't want to jam all your threats into the battlefield. Like, you might even want to sandbag the Asika's Chariot for a turn. Like, you wish for it right away, but you might sandbag it for a turn, and then use the second turn you have a Karn to Pestilent Cauldron as Restorative Burst to, like, get back some threats. You should try to jam the flashback storm in the festival like as fast as you can, even into a known counter spell, just so you can get out of your graveyard before it gets farewelled away. And going back to the point I made before, for the most part, you want to do whatever you can to make farewell as not backbreaking. Some draws you have, you just won't be allowed to do that. But if you can, you want to optimize your game such that you aren't destroyed by farewell, and you can ideally answer it to fairy the turn it comes down. In terms of deck building considerations, also, if you expect there to be a lot of blue-white, I'm very interested in playing both the Nissa Vital Force, the Kaladesh Nissa, and Nicol Bolas again, because these are both really good against Teferi and the blue-white plan in general. So if you expect that a lot, you want to have more Planeswalkers in the flex slots and less Voracious Hydras and Pelucranoses. But mostly the game is about just not getting owned by Farewell.
Yeah, that card is especially crushing. Like, there's a long list of things that it handles, like it's very specifically Planeswalkers that you need to have on the battlefield. So like one of the other things I found when I was playing this deck was that you would often try to cast two of your Planeswalkers in the same turn to overload their answers and be leading with the other threats.
Yes, that is a very common dynamic.
Any other matchups which you think are either common enough that they deserve some discussion or interesting enough in some way, even if they're less common, that it is worth touching on?
See, I'll touch briefly on a couple. For Greasefang, often you want a plus with your Karn. For the reason I mentioned before, they can't crew their vehicles. I don't know how good or bad this matchup is. I think it's pretty draw dependent because they have like six discard spells, but you have four Karns. And they also have Witherbloom Command that can kill both a Wolf Willowhaven and an Elf with one card. So I don't know if the matchup is very good or bad, but I think it's very draw dependent. If you have like an unlicensed Hearth in your sideboard, I would actually board that in over a Wolf Willowhaven. But that's the Greasefang matchup. And then maybe there's two other I'll discuss really briefly just in terms of the kind of hand composition you want. Because, I mean, in general, you want hands that like execute your deck's game plan. Your deck's game plan is very scripted. Against Hidden Strings specifically, which, Dom, I think you mentioned earlier, you think this has sort of fallen off. But in case you do face it, you should mulligan basically any 7-card hand that doesn't have either a Karn or a turn 3 Storm. But you should keep most 6-card hands if you can help it. And then for the Mono Blue Spirits matchup, if you know you're playing it or for post-board games, your 7-card hand must be able to produce either a turn 2 Troll or a turn 3 Cavalier. And I would mulligan basically any 7-card hand that didn't have that property. But also, realistically, the matchup is quite bad. So, like, if they have a turn 2 Curious Obsession, you're just going to lose. And there's no agency you really had in that. So you just kind of have to accept that as part of playing the deck and hope to dodge. But those are two specific hand composition pieces of advice I have for specifically the Hidden Strings and Mono Blue Spirits matchups.
That ties into our final important point here, which is mulligan decisions in the dark or on the whole, where we mentioned earlier one of the common fail cases of the deck is you have like a one land hand that has a Nykthos, you have to mulligan, and then you kind of find yourself in garbage time pretty quickly. There are also hands a little higher in the range where you can see how they could be good, and if you fix certain assumptions in place, you know they probably will be good, but there's an obvious way things could go south. So for example, you have, let's say, your one green source, a Nykthos, an Elf, and then a bunch of stuff that's higher up the curve, and if your Elf lives, you're probably good to go. If it doesn't, then the whole hand kind of falls apart and does nothing. How do you weigh up hands like that, or some of these opening hands in general, when you don't have any prior information to work with?
Well, looking at, you know, a companion they might reveal, you know, helps, and then if they don't reveal a companion, that actually does, you know, narrow down the set of decks they could be playing. For the kind of hand composition you described, if they're the threats that are a bit lower down the curve, then, you know, it's more likely to keep. If they're, say, like All Storm in the festivals, then that's a bit worse. But with any deck, you sort of need to look at your opening hand and figure out, like, what do I need to go right to win this game? And if the answer is I only need to have draw, like, one of a large class of cards, like, you need one mana source or you need one other accelerant, it's probably good to keep. I mean, if your hand doesn't do anything on the first two turns, it's probably pretty bad. But you just want your deck to do something. Like, you have a core game plan, and the thing is, your deck does not play that, like, removal spells. You can't interact in a traditional game of Magic. You can't, like, you know, play in, like, a medium-ish threat, and then, like, you draw an answer card, and they have an answer card. Like, it's not like playing a Jund Mirror or a Rakdos Mirror. You're playing, like, a ramp combo deck, and so if your opening hand does not execute a ramp combo deck game plan, then, like, you should probably go to five. Because this deck can also win on five pretty easily. You go turn one Elf, turn two Kiora, turn three, Cavalier of Thorns, draw a card, get a land, like get a Nykthos. You're off to the races. You like Millstorm the Festival. They're going to die on turn four, or you're going to functionally win the game on turn four. So you should be pretty willing to go to five if you need to, because you do have pretty nutty draws. Like I was watching Darth Jason's like stream earlier today, and he mulliganed four, and he had essentially the sequence I just described, and he won pretty handily like on turn four. Off the combination of like, you know, Cure and the Cavalier. Don't be afraid to mulligan if you can't execute the game plan of your deck.
Right, that I mean, it makes basic level sense of like keep hands that function and don't keep hands that don't function.
Yeah, I think gives a pretty comprehensive overview of the deck. Ari, any final thoughts to touch on here?
I think one thing I noticed was your matchup guide seemed somewhat negative, and I think a lot of that just has to do, it's like a function of how decks like this work, where you only have to really worry about the games where your opponent gets to play. And a lot of the games, like, this reads like a deck guide for a deck that is, like, 40% versus the field, when in reality you just get, like, a quarter of your games, your opponent is not remotely in the ballpark of what you're doing, and you've just made 40 mana off Nykthos before they can do anything. So I think that that is also something to look out for as you're playing, which is, like, the games that you lose tend to feel scrappy and bad, but, like, don't forget the games that you just win for free anyways.
Yeah, and for people playing against this deck, those are the games they remember the most, like the ones where they got totally destroyed. But on the inverse of that is when you're, you know, playing this deck, don't discount the value of, you just, like, there's some fraction of games you just sort of get free wins. And free wins are great. I love free wins. I think Ari, in previous articles you've written, you sort of emphasized the importance of free wins. Like free wins are great. And so, you know, the games where you don't get the free wins, you know, they're a bit tougher. But there's also a hard lower bound to how bad a deck can be when you just win the game instantly some fraction of the time, like with, you know, with Amulet Bloom, sometimes you just won the game on turn two, like 10% of the time. So there's kind of a hard lower bound on how bad even your worst matchups can be when you have the out of you just win the game on turns three or turn four.
Yeah, I think Pioneer is a format where things don't tend to get that polarized. Like you don't really have like an Amulet versus Infect situation or anything like that. But equally, even in the matchups which are supposedly bad for mono green, stuff like mono blue spirits and so on, I feel like if I'm on the play with a good draw, I kind of like my odds against basically anything.
Any parting thoughts on the deck that you want to add, Bobby? Because you know we've covered a lot of small details, but if there's any overarching thoughts that didn't fit somewhere, now is the perfect time to wrap it up with them.
I guess I'll just reemphasize the deck building points I made earlier, which is if you listen to this podcast and you thought that you learned a lot from it, then just listen to what I say with this advice for how to build your deck. You should play four Kiora. Your land in the sideboard should be Darksteel Citadel. You should try to have 13 cards with the type forest on them. You should probably not put Fatal Push in your Storm the Festival deck. And if you're adding planeswalkers that have color requirements other than just green to cast, you should think very critically about whether these meet the high bar to be put in your deck.
All right. So with that, I guess we can wrap things up. If you want to be contacted, where should people be, you know, finding you and following what you're putting out there?
People can follow me on Twitter. I don't post on Twitter pretty frequently, maybe a single digit number of times a year. I guess when I feel the inclination, I've occasionally written for Channel Fireball or Star City a few times each. So if I write something, you know, you can find me there. But I'd say Twitter is probably the best place. My Twitter handle is my name, Bobby Fortinelli, all one word.
Perfect. So yeah, Bobby, thank you so much for joining us. I hope this was informative for a lot of people. It seems like Mono Green isn't going anywhere, and you should learn to beat them or learn to join them, and I think this will help you do both. So thank you for joining us once again.
Yeah, glad to be invited.
All right, so after that bounty of information, let's cleanse our palate here with some nonsense of the week. And I did not have anything in mind for this, and we were trying to think about how to fill in the segment, but friend of the show, Xenoman, really rose to the occasion here with a 5-0 league finish with, what would we even call this? I think Esper Wizards is, you know, this is how it would get entered into a database, and that is woefully underselling it.
I think I would like to call it the best ad nauseum deck of all time because it has the minimum amount of ad nauseum to be called an ad nauseum deck.
Yes, so this is effectively, there is a combo kill here. This is a, in the vein of the CFT Sock Spellseeker Ephemerate deck, this is a Ephemerate Micromancer deck where you can Ephemerate the Micromancer to get combo pieces. You can get Angel's Grace or Spoils of the Vault, which then set you up to go off with that three card combo with Thassa's Oracle. And if it seems like a lot of that is tough to stitch together, well, luckily we can step through that problem with Step Through, which is this Modern Horizons card, 3 blue-blue, return 2 target creatures to their owner's hands for 5 mana. Not that appealing even in limited necessarily, but it has Wizard Cycling for 2. And so we have this funky wizard toolbox in the deck where we have a Meddling Mage, which against some of these combo decks, right, we, you know, turn 2 will cycle this, turn 3 will Meddling Mage naming Living End or Calibrated Blast, and that's what we're going for here. We have a Snapcaster Mage to buy back some of our other spells we've used. We have the 1,000 Oracle to enable these combo kills, as well as the Micromancers. But then the one that really speaks to me is the one copy of a new card here, Urtai Resurrected. So this is 2 blue-black, flash, 3/2. When it ETBs, you choose up to one. You can counter target spell or ability, and its controller draws a card. Or you destroy target creature or planeswalker, and its controller draws a card, which some like vague Arcane Denial vibes, but the threats and the things you want to hit with this are so good these days that you'll gladly give them a card back if you can just deal permanently with it. And the fact that this sets up some like Urtai Ephemerate loops, which are really nice. We have a Silence in the deck even, so we can keep like looping that one through with our Snapcaster Mage. There is a lot of cool stuff going on here. We have the one Riptide Lab to keep recurring our Urtai or our Snapcaster Mage or what have you. I love everything that's going on here.
Yeah, this reminds me a lot of Venser, except for when you were, this is Venser Shaper Savant, the one from Future Sight that bounces a permanent or a spell. Except for when you Vensered their thing, the card that they drew was always the thing that you killed, and it's not like, oh, they drew a land. So it's Venser with a lot of upside. I've drafted Urtai a number of times, and it is basically unbeatable in limited, and only feel like in a way that feels like it could even be more magnified in other formats. So I'm excited to play with it here. I do want to note that this is like the Micromancer Ephemerate loops going on in this deck are just crazy.
Yeah, there is a lot of weird stuff you can turn up, which our reservation with Micromancer before was one mana really does constrict what you can do, and a lot of the one mana spells normally are quite generic, right? Like it's your cantrips like Consider, or it's your removal like Unholy Heat, and that's fine to a point, but sometimes you need more stuff for the juice to be worth the squeeze. And when you can get, you know, Angel's Grace, Spoils of the Vault, the one Flusterstorm in the main deck, the one Silence, a Cling to Dust, even like there is a lot to a lot of options to explore. I also love the remnants of these overlapping like Step Through and Micromancer toolboxes in the sideboard, where this is, it's not the full 15 monos. We do have 2 copies of Flusterstorm, but we have 14 distinct cards, and I'm not sure which of these toolboxes is more impressive in a way. So the Micromancer one, we have a Ceremonious Rejection for all of the kind of big mana decks and like Tron and so on. We have a Gutshot, always a nice one, a Surgical Extraction. We have an Echoing Return. So this is black for Disentomb that also disentombs everything else with the same name, so you can buy back all of your Micromancers or all of your Solitudes, which is like, that's another angle here, right? This is the primary thing that you want to be pairing your Ephemerate with, and then the Micromancer stuff is almost an afterthought. But then that almost has nothing on the Step Through toolbox, where we have a Baroten Forgetender, easy to forget that one is a wizard, and we have a Nimble Obstructionist for when you need new and even more obscure ways to counter triggers and so on. We have a Tide Shaper, which, like, if your opponent plays Urza Saga and you cycle Step Through for a Tide Shaper, like, I would just pack the game up at that point. I would not want to continue playing. We have a Mist Caller, which, in a format where Hallowed Moonlight is becoming a popular sideboard card in the face of Creativity, Living End, Yawgmoth, and so on, Mist Caller is that effect stapled to a one mana body, so you have access to that there. And then I think my favorite thing of all is the Teferi Mage of Zalfir. Really takes me back to the days where, like, people like Sam Pardee had this plan for the Twin Mirror that was just Cabinet of Souls plus Teferi, and there was really nothing you could do to interrupt that Teferi, and once the Teferi was down, there was nothing else you could do at your own pace there. So I kind of love that we have all of these new cards being used in very funky ways, and some nice, you know, Riptide Lab, Teferi callbacks as well.
Did I miss you discussing the main deck card that got me the most? Because it's hiding over there in the lands.
The Reptide Lab? Oh, no. No. Okay, this is the one that... Yes, this is the Umara Wizard. One of the... Certainly one of the Zendikar Rising DFCs that exists. You know, does something on the front end for 5 mana, tapped blue land on the back, but it's a wizard. And so if you're really missing that third mana source, you can cycle step through for a wizard that you can then play as a land if that's going to cure what ails you.
Yeah, I believe the front side is like a 5-mana 4/3 that gains flying when you... Yeah, whenever you play an instant sorcery or wizard, it jumps. So, very low quality, but technically a spell, but mostly just like... Your step through is just the strangest Eternal Dragon of all time.
Yes, so an excellent offering there from our esteemed nonsense correspondent. Hopefully we'll be hearing a lot more from them in the future. If you want to hear more from us, you can find our columns each week over at SEG and TCG Player, respectively. You can find the podcast, of course, on Patreon at patreon.com/dominarius_judgment. You can find us on Twitter at dominjavier and at ARMLX, or find the podcast at dominaria_pod. And then you can find us and some increasing number of people in the Discord, including Xenoban, giving you an early preview of all of the nonsense circulating in their brain there.
Yeah. So, yeah, like I said earlier, the Discord is linked in the pinned tweets on our Twitter account, so go check that out there. A lot of good chatter about Modern. People have been asking about various decks, and a lot of good back-and-forth discussion about that. A lot of back-and-forth discussion about the format. A lot of back-and-forth concerns about what the future of the format looks like when Gandalf is a staple card, but, you know, we can talk about that later. Just
hold up.
Overall, a good place Gandalf to hang out.
Wait, Gandalf is a wizard, right?
Yes, so, there will in fact be Gandalf in that deck when it comes to 2023.
So, hot MTG finance tip: get your step throughs, get your Riptide Labs early, and you too can get in on the ground floor here. But with that, we will conclude this very fun and very nice episode, and we will see all of you next week. Take care, everyone.